It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And we are off and running here at midweek in the first week of December as we wind down 2018. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us. That's where you go if you want to click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password if you've never done that before. And jump right into the Merry Madcap Wacky Zany real-time multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn Chat during the hours in which this program is live from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you do all that, well, you will be immediately greeted by the likes of Heather and Laurel and Otto and VT Blom and Warrior Witch and more to come, and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has folded space to become Man Cave. Yes. Thanks for popping by. Well, there went Sparky. Okay. Well, at any rate, I was kind of surprised to see Sparky in there because he usually takes Wednesdays off, Wednesday being prayer meeting Wednesday, and Sparky not being a big one for religious flummery. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and it is prayer meeting Wednesday on the Horn. We find ourselves dealing with a humdinger of a fundraising hole already here in the earliest part of December. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. Brother Deacon Asa says, the good news is streaming 5x5 on both blessed servers from on high. The congregation is eager to discern the spirits. Hallelujah. Ha! Hallelujah and glory. P.S. I have the bone saw at the ready for anybody who doesn't want to contribute when we pass the plate. Well, we're not gonna get that harsh about it. But speaking of bone saws, I couldn't help noticing that the Saudi ambassador to the United States was in attendance today at the funeral of George H.W. Bush. Do you suppose they had a metal detector there and had to take his bone saw and sword away from him? I don't know. I simply do not know. But that being the case, yeah, we've got a $490 fundraising goal this evening. That's tough. That means, yesterday and today and just a little bit of Monday, and we can get up even, but, we really need to do some catching up. The little old ladies before we get there, thanks go out to our subscribers. Thank you to Roberto. Thank you very kindly, Roberto. And thanks as well to Kevin in Colorado Springs. Thank you to James in Illinois. And thank you to Roland and Edward. And thanks very kindly to Kenda for being subscribers on this, the fifth day of the month. If you'd like to be a subscriber, they'd love to have your company on the fifth day of the month. It's real easy. You just click on PayPal at headon.live, and you check the little box that says make this happen every month or whatever it is it says there. Mm-hmm. And that's how the subscriptions work. But thank you to each and every one of our subscribers. Thanks as well go out to our Patreon subscribers. Thank you to Alec. Thank you, Andy. To Brother Deacon Asa, thank you. Thank you to Barb. Thank you to Barbara. Thank you to Brendan. To David. To different David. Thank you to Eric in Pennsylvania, Bamistan. Thank you to Irwin. Thanks to Foam Cups. Thank you to Frank. Thank you to Frank Fab. Thanks to Glenn and Greg. Thank you to Hamilton. Thank you to Horst. Thank you to Johan. Thank you very kindly to Jeremy in Vermont. Thanks to Jim. And thanks to John. Thanks to John. Different John. Thank you to Johannes in Colorado. Thank you very kindly to John again. It's tough. I can't use the I don't use last names here because but hopefully you know if you're subscribed to Patreon whom you are. Thank you to Joyce and thank you to Karen. Thank you very kindly to Carl. Thanks to Kat. Thanks to Kimberly. Thank you to Margaret. Peggy. Thank you, Peggy. Thank you very kindly to Marty and to Marty, whom we hear from time to time via email. Thank you to Matthew. Thank you to Michael and Nick. Thanks very kindly to Patrick in Germany. Thank you to Ron and Rico. Thank you to Robin and Rocky. Thank you to Scott. Thank you to Sonny. Thank you to Steve in New York. Thank you to Stephen. Thank you to Susan. Thanks, Terrace. Thanks to the Nubian. Thank you very kindly to Thomas. Thank you to Timothy. Thank you to Tina. And thank you very kindly to our buddy Hung Like Jesus. Thank you to the Union of Concerned Scientists. And thank you to Vernon. Those are our Patreon subscribers. Thank you very, very kindly. We knock out almost... we knock out almost 2 days of funding thanks to Patreon. Not quite, but almost. And so, those are the subscriber thank yous this evening. And well, brethren and sistren, I just wanted to let you know that the little old blue-haired ladies decided it was chicken stew time again, and worked up a big old pot of it and a big pan of cornbread to go with it. Most people, you know, usually don't think of soup as, but my goodness gracious, this is so much more than just soup. It was filling and rib sticking. Of course, there was some coleslaw alongside there, and over on the dessert table, well, a whole table full of chocolate meringue pies, yes. And the deacons went after those with a will, and having consumed them down to nothing, not even a crumb remaining, they trundled their massive bulk up the couple of flights of stairs from the basement hall of fellowship hall and set to smoking with the sinners because, well, they know they're going to be working this evening. The plates are going to have to pass and pass and pass and pass because, as I noted, we're about $490 in the hole. And front end of the month bills to be paid. So that's where that stands. Brethren and sistren, I'm going to tell you that the poor deacons, well, be careful. They may be a little unsure of themselves because it's cold outside and freezing and some snow and sleet spitting through the air. And so their grip on the heavy brass-bound, velvet-lined collection plates may not be what it should be. And they even moved a little bit slow when Sister Carol Baker waved the horn solar-powered cattle prod at them. They just, well, they're kind of reptilian, the deacons are, and they slow down in cold weather. But they eventually made their way past her, made their way through the vestibule, went on past that desiccating bowl of butter mints and found their way down front, and they're waiting now with the heavy brass-bound, velvet-lined collection plates in hand, and they're preparing to move through the congregation even as I speak. Yes. And we will call up the Minister of Music to lead us in the offertory prayer. Brother Minister of Music, if you would, please.
And he said, it's time for you to leave behind the things of this world. The fine houses, the fancy cars, the flashy clothes, because we are all naked in the eyes of the Lord.
Stop! This man is clinically insane!
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen!
Amen!
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord!
Praise the Lord!
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around!
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around!
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah! Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Ha! Hallelujah, amen. Hutsut Ralston on the Rilla Raw and a brawl of brawl of suet. I love you. Welcome, brethren and sister, to prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn. Ha! Amen. Glory. Hallelujah. I'm calling on you now because we do things a little bit different here in the cathedral. We have the altar call first and the preaching later. I'm calling on you to get up off of your seats and get onto your feet. Amen. And scrunch and screech and wiggle and waggle and waddle and move without rhythm so you won't attract the worms. And come on out and come on down that blood red aisle and fall, brethren and sisters, upon your knees. And lay your hands, amen, glory, upon the subwoofer. And feel the healing rays of common sense a-flowing through you from the server on high. Amen, glory. I am Archpope, Uber Rabbi, Ultimate Imam, Animated Animus, Ponerized Pontiff, Vicarious Vicar, Maximum Metropolitan, Munificent Mufti, Bob Kincaid, and this is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Going out across the land and across the world to non-believers, to those in darkness, to the shut-ins. Glory, hallelujah, amen. And we have so much, brethren and sistren, so much to discuss. I can tell you that the first round has been made by the deacons, amen. Oh, and I tell you, it's rough. It's tough. But we're making a little bit of progress here and there. We are. The first round of plate passing done come back. And thank you. Thank you very kindly. Thank you very kindly to Joseph. Bob, this here is a donation of thanksgiving. Well, this is a little bit sad. My mother is dying, and I had a nice dinner with you last night. We got a lot of stuff ironed out, thanks to all my Horn Family Community Congregation for helping keep me sane at this time. Yeah, you can't do the shtick in with something like that. Thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Thank you very kindly. That's very, very kind and very generous of you. And my best, our best, our warmest thoughts go out to your mother and to you in a difficult and painless and painful time. And I hope her remaining time is painless. So it is prayer meeting Wednesday, and we will we'll get to the lessons now. America got a little reminder earlier today of one of those things, and I mean I couldn't recite it if my soul depended upon it, and some folks actually believe one's soul does. I don't. There was a recitation during the funeral of George H.W. Bush today at the National Cathedral. There was a recitation of Apollo Creed. Sorry, wrong. The Apostles' Creed. Different creed, Apollo Creed. There was a recitation of the Apostles' Creed, and everybody had it written down in front of them in printed form. The whole room did. I guess there was even a copy for Ambassador Bonesaw, although I don't expect he repeated it. That would have been a heresy, and they probably would have chopped his little old pumpkin head off when he got back to his barbaric country. Maybe Mohammed bin Salman would have had him chopped into tiny pieces, you know, right there in Washington, D.C. You just never know when you're dealing with Saudi barbarians. But what was particularly interesting was that there stood Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Jimmy Carter and Rosalind Carter. And they're Baptists. And us Baptists, I mean, I was one once. I guess I'm still on the rolls somewhere. Once saved, once saved, always saved, y'all. I mean, us Baptists, we feel real funny when it gets to that line about the Holy Catholic Church. We get kind of creeped out by that. But it's little c Catholic, meaning universal. But we don't do the Apostles' Creed, Baptists don't, or at least not Southern Baptists like I was raised. But there was President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalind Carter, class acts, both of them, doing the Apostles' Creed with everybody else except, that's right, President Bonespurs and the first stripper, I mean lady, Melanoma Trump. Melanoma kept her hands clasped before her and her head sort of bowed, but Julius Geezer stared straight off into the distance, kept the script in his hand, lowered down by his groin, and said nothing. Now, was this I'm sure by the time the QAnon folks get done with it, this will be some sort of secret high sign or something. But the fact of the matter is, no, I think he didn't do the Apostles' Creed because, A, he has no idea what it is, and, B, because he's not much in the way of a reader. No. And so, this is, after all, a guy who fired up the presidential motorcade to travel all of 250 yards from the White House to Blair House to visit with the Bush family in advance of the funeral. But we do religious stuff on Wednesdays, brethren and sistren, and there it was. He couldn't, and I'm pretty sure it's not because he's some sort of a, evil, real hardcore fundamentalist, hard shell Baptist, whatever, who isn't allowed to repeat it. I mean, if Jimmy Carter can, anybody can. But, there it was. They sang, too, and he didn't sing. And he fidgeted, and he squirmed like a four-year-old. Because every time something decent was said about George H.W. Bush, I suspect he knew that everybody in the building was thinking, yeah, and Trump's not like that. But enough of that. If you watched it, you watched it. If you didn't, you didn't. If you can kind of set aside the personalities, namely the guest of honor in the box, or all the dignitaries who show up, it was quite the spectacle. But I do have one suggestion for the dean of the National Cathedral. Every so often before the ceremony started, and a couple of times during, they had a camera set up for a long shot down the length of the National Cathedral. And it was a long, high shot, so it was up by the rafters, I reckon you'd call them. And because it is the National Cathedral, the flags of all the states and territories hang there way up high. Alabama was easily identified because it's basically a modified St. Andrew's cross. White crossed red stripes on a white background. But on the right, and that was on the left, but on the right-hand side, down a few flags, in just glaring obscenity, hung the flag of the state of Mississippi Stan. Which, of course, has an element of it, in the upper left corner, a recreation of the Confederate battle flag. Or the devil's diaper, as our buddy Bruce once termed it. And it just stuck out. Your eye was just drawn to it. And so my suggestion for the dean of the National Cathedral is that he write a very, or she, I'm not sure who the dean of the National Cathedral is these days, write a very polite letter saying the flag of the state of Mississippi will be removed from hanging in the National Cathedral until such time as they remove that element of treason, division, and hatred from their state banner. Because it's in a place called the National Cathedral, it's about national unity. And I don't know how the other 49 states can... Well, okay, we'll leave out the states of the Confederacy because they probably wish they had them some Confederate flag iconography in their flags, like Georgia took theirs out. And remember, that filth was only added into flags during the Civil Rights Movement as a warning and an act of resistance. But it would be a great moment of moral clarity from a religious institution to say, sorry, not going to fly it as long as that damn thing's on there. And maybe that would finally get through to them. But hey, we're just a little radio show, so who can say? But it did. It was offensive as hell. It was, dare I say, vulgar. I mean, the funeral of a former president was held, for all intents and purposes, beneath a flag of treason and murderous intent. Ponder that for a moment. It's a pity we don't have the outreach here, because maybe we could get some people trying to communicate with the dean of the National Cathedral and just sort of making them aware of it. And aware of how odious and vulgar such a thing is in a shrine to our national unity. Lee in New York says, howdy, Bob. Expect Sarah Sanders to talk about the size of the crowd at the funeral because President Donald John Trump was there. Trump will tweet about it, too. Biggest attendance ever. Biggest attendance ever. I was there. I would know. And it was because of me. It was all about me. Yeah, the dummy tweeted that it wasn't a funeral, but a celebration of a man's life. Listen, the folks with the funny clothes came out and the funny hardware and said religious mumblings over the coffin. It was most definitely a funeral. You know, committing the soul into the hands of the Creator and all of and the hope of the resurrection and all the, you know, everything that goes, all the stuff that goes with those magic spells they use. But the singing was beautiful, and it was telling. There was a camera on the ex-president's there. Before the event got started, and you know they were all chatting with each other and laughing and smiling, and then all of a sudden, Julius Geezer and Melanoma walked up, and they all shut up, because all pleasantry ended at that moment. Yeah. And then there was the swanning around before everyone took their seats. And at one point in time, the camera caught and then quickly cut away. Count Dicula and Mike Pencilneck Geek sitting there just a yucking it up and smiling and grinning at each other and looking at each other with grins on their faces like foxes eating shit out of wire brushes. And I just thought in that moment, well, son of a gun. There it is. There's the through line of Republican politics. A homicidal old maniac with in the form of Dick Cheney, laughing and smiling with Donald Trump's vice president. Yep. A not so gentle reminder that, as I've said so often, it ain't all about Trump. Some of this is just plain old-fashioned, dirty Republican politics. Okay, Darlene in Connecticut says, that's kind of mean, Bob. Not all Saudis kill and bonesaw journalists that criticize the Saudi regime. That's true, not all Saudis. But full disclosure, says Darlene, I'm struggling a bit with absolutely hating MBS. My eldest nephew could pass as his body double. So I see my nephew when I see MBS. Granted, their temperaments vastly diverge, but it's frightening. Of course, if my nephew were to apply as MBS's doppelganger, he'd be paid handsomely, but MBS would eventually have to kill him for the privilege. At this point, my brother's trying to get my nephew to shave his beard so he's not accidentally mistaken. I'll have to cogitate on this a bit more, because a longtime friend of mine was the spit and image of Osama bin Laden. And I'm part Russian. Oh, shit. Should I have admitted to any of this? Actually, I think Agent Fred would be thrilled that I have a bit of spice in my life. I was once told that the FBI most likely has a file on me. And my guess is Agent Fred's been bored to tears with me for sure, as I pretty much live like a nun. Or at least I play one on TV. Well, thank you, Darlene. Yes, not all Saudis. But this particular Saudi was the Saudi ambassador to the United States. He's the little skinny guy who, and of course, the Saudi royal family is dear, 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 dear friends with the Bush family, as we all recall, back when Bandar Prince Bandar was the ambassador. The Bushes referred to him as Bandar Bush because he loved to smoke cigars with the Bush boys and go to Dallas Cowboys or somebody or another football games and all that kind of carrying on. They called him Bandar Bush. But this is Prince Jubal, something like that. And he was the one who came on TV recently to declare that the Saudis were shocked, I tell you, shocked, to find out that there was murder going on against Virginian journalists. Yeah, I reckon Jamal Khashoggi had a Virginia license, and that would have made him a Virginian of sorts. I can remember when Virginians would get all testy about anybody, say, cutting up a Virginian into small pieces. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it is, very funny, Marty. Darlene plays a nun, Marty asks. Can she fly? You know, the flying nun. Try not to groan too loudly. No cowbell for that, Marty. No cowbell at all. Lee in New York says, priests objecting to slavery? I know you know the Old Testament has plenty of God-sanctioned slavery. Object to states with reference to slavery? I really do doubt it. Yeah, but these are the Episcopals, and they're supposed to be kind of liberalish and social justice-y and whatnot. Yeah. So anyway, prayer meeting Wednesday stuff. It's Hanukkah for practitioners of the Jewish faith. Designated holiday that whose specific date is laid out in the scripture of some sort. And so this being prayer meeting Wednesday. A little lesson on how not to wish Happy Hanukkah to Jewish people. Brought to you by the publication, the National Catholic Reporter. They did, and they were trying to be kind of ecumenical about it. So they issued the Catholic News Service, my bad. Not National Catholic Reporter. Denominational news agency, the Catholic News Service, out of the United States, on Sunday, put up a post that read, Hanukkah began at sundown. Happy Hanukkah to those who celebrate. Now, they could have simply put up a photograph of a menorah, or they could have put up a picture of some of those little chocolate Hanukkah geld coins that the kids get. But no, they were going for something classical. And so the accompanying photo that went with the tweet Sunday showed a bas-relief carving from the Arch of Titus in Rome. Now, this is a little bit of that nerdy ancient history that I'm so darn fond of, but along about 68-ish, 66-ish CE, which would probably be a good 36 years after the crucifixion, if it took place, there was some trouble in Palestine. It was a revolt. It was an uprising. And the Romans had to put it down. And they waged a bloody war, and it was bloody on both sides. It was simply referred to as the Jewish War. And you can read about it in the ancient works of Flavius Josephus. But it finally ended in about 74 of the current era. And it ended badly for the home team. And so the Romans, who didn't take kindly to revolutions in what they perceived to be their territories, destroyed the Temple of Herod, leaving only the Western Wall, and carried off all of the temple's goodies to Rome, which is what the Romans did when they conquered somebody or whipped somebody. They took all of their nice stuff, and then they went back to Rome, and they had a big-ass parade. And in the big-ass parade, they carried all the stuff that they had looted from their defeated victim. And Titus, who went on to be an emperor, the Flavian dynasty, for instance, that building that we call the Colosseum, well, the Romans didn't call it the Colosseum. They called it the Flavian Amphitheater, because it was an amphitheater, a really damn big one, we'd call it a stadium, that was built by the Flavian dynasty. But anyway, in order to memorialize the great victory, they built a triumphal arch. It stands to this day. It's called the Arch of Titus. And one of the reliefs carved into the Arch of Titus shows Romans carrying away the temple's menorah. You know, the multi-pronged candlestick, for those who aren't familiar with it. Right. And they, I mean, that relief shows them carrying back a whole bunch of stuff, but the menorah is particular and prominent. And yes, in fact, a photograph of the bas-relief of the menorah being looted from the temple was what the Catholic News Service used by way of wishing a happy Hanukkah to people who celebrate it. It would be a little bit like, oh, I don't know, wishing, I'm trying to think, wishing the people of Japan a happy holiday unique to Japanese culture with a photograph of a mushroom cloud. For centuries, Jewish people refused to even walk through the arch because it was such a hateful and shameful and painful reminder of what happened to them when they lost that war in 74 CE. It would be like, since we were talking about it, I'm hoping that maybe come Kwanzaa, the Catholic News Service can be counted on not to wish people celebrating a happy celebrating Kwanzaa, not sending those good wishes along with a photograph of, say, the Confederate battle flag. There. Yeah, or as Brother Deacon Asa says, it would be like flying the devil's diaper to celebrate the 4th of July and say, oh, Massachusetts. Yeah, right. And to their credit, though, the Catholic News Service yanked it as quick as they got caught. Josh Marshall over at Talking Points Memo was the one who saw it and went, whoa, what? And when they got caught, the folks at Catholic News Service, well, they deleted the tweet, and then they tweeted, Sunday, we inadvertently posted an offensive photo. We were sloppy in our tweeting. People were right to be offended. They followed that tweet up by saying the person who posted the tweet now fully understands the implications of the picture. We apologize again. And I want to give credit to Catholic News Service for the manner in which they apologized. You'll notice there was none of that Republican-style apologizing going on there. We apologize if anyone was offended. Instead, Catholic News Service said it was offensive and people were right to be offended. I don't think it was inadvertently posted. It was posted without proper knowledge. I guess they, whoever's doing the tweeting for Catholic News Service was not paying attention in Latin class. I'd like to think they had Latin class. But, you know, not a, good on them for handling it the way they did, but gee whiz. I mean, really? Oh, and by the way, before I start getting emails about it, the noise you hear in the background here, well, that's the fan of a laptop. Because toward the end of the program last night, I discovered we've had another equipment failure. They're going to happen from time to time. The laptop that we use to handle Skype and and one of the phone lines, the keyboard decided to die. So roughly the left half of the keyboard just didn't work. When, for instance, I pressed the letter, the S key, it would take the volume down, but it would not type the letter S. The letter E was also down for the count. So that high-pitched whine that you may hear in the background is an 8-year-old really, really noisy laptop, which has been, right before Dr. Bill this afternoon, Agnes and I put it into service just so we could still have Skype, which is integral to so much of what we do here. So that's what the noise is. Ron and Raleigh with a note. Whew! All this hagiography is making me tired. Thank goodness for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! The last few days on that show, the real story of H.W. Bush has been on display. Hell, they even brought up some shit that I'd forgotten. I kept wondering what the hagiography would be when Hank Kissinger and Dolt 45 went on to their long homes. By the way, I saw them wheeling Hellboy Hank Kissinger into the cathedral. Once again, my lack of belief in a supreme deity, a vengeful God, a great big bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky, was confirmed when Kissinger went right through the doorway into the cathedral and no lightning bolts. No lightning bolts for a whole lot of people. But, yeah. As to their funerals, Ron notes, it will no doubt be even more disgusting than this tissue of lies that has accompanied the passing of H.W. The good is not being interred with his bones. And I feel like I did enough of a job over the years of talking about the awful things that family has done. But one thing attaches, and I don't think Ron would argue with me on this, we find ourselves dealing with sliding scales. When H.W. was elected, I didn't like it, and the fact that he had to rely on an approved and overtly racist ad as part of his election effort did not speak well. It just made him who he was. It sort of Dennis Greened him. He was who we thought he was. but you let a little time pass and his boy becomes president, and all of a sudden HW starts looking more and more like a statesman. I did take a moment to wonder if at the funeral, though, they would I wondered if there was maybe even one old leftover Nicaraguan Contra who could show up there, because, of course, H.W. was a dear, dear friend to the Nicaraguan Contras. You could say he was their second biggest fan behind old 666 Ronald Wilson Reagan, who once compared the Nicaraguan Contras to the Founding Fathers. You know, as the Contras raped and murdered their way through the jungles of Nicaragua, sure. But the, didn't see any of them in the audience. No. And I too pondered, as did yesterday Barry Friedman, and again I commend to you his futuristic satire on the funeral of Donald J. Trump. I can't imagine anyone using the words that were used to describe H.W. to describe Donald Trump. They simply do not apply. But it will be a sickening grief orgy. And as I sat there watching President and Mrs. Carter, I thought, long life to you, Jimmy. Long, long, long life to you. Lee in New York, a note, Hanukkah. Hanukkah is actually a minor holiday because it's not in the Bible. It's historically recorded. It appears in the Book of Maccabees, I believe. The only reason it's significant in America's is its calendar proximity to Christmas. Because Christmas is a gift holiday, Hanukkah became a gift holiday, sarcastically. That you merchandise sellers. I get that, but hey, you need a holiday around the solstice. Every human culture finds a way to mark and to celebrate the rebirth of the sun. S-U-N. And we're not all that far away from the winter solstice and these grim, darkening days that I find it more and more difficult to get through. The days get a little longer after about the 23rd of December. And the winter gets worse, but every day is a day closer to spring and the renewal of life on this little blue-green marble that's hurtling through the universe. I had already thought about that, but thanks, Lee. Lee says the cheap solution, tech support. The cheap solution to a non-working laptop keyboard is to have a USB-attached keyboard or wireless keyboard. A USB keyboard should be around $20. Your tech problems are our priority. Thank you for waiting. We're experiencing high call volume due to the holidays. But thank you, Lee. That's probably what I'm going to do. And then we'll have another loose keyboard laying around here, and that'll be a real party. That's a good question. Irish Dave says, so on Happy Confederate Memorial Day, can we offer our thoughts and prayers in a card with a picture of Atlanta burning and such as? Well, yeah. And, of course, I even remarked while we were down there last week, I told Agnes, there probably should be a citywide holiday around about the anniversary of the burning of Atlanta, because that's what made Atlanta, Atlanta. It came back, and it was bigger and stronger. Worth thinking about. Well, that's true. Randy in PA says if they only would have thrown Kissinger and Cheney into the coffin, they would have had a trifecta. Mm-hmm. Where was Cheney anyway? He was there. He was there, and he was yucking it up with Mike Pence. That's how he laughs. Okay, this is just too weird for damn words. I talk about the dead laptop, and an ad pops up on my monitor for the Samsung Galaxy Book 2. Lasts longer, works harder. Okay, great. That's just freaking weird. That doesn't happen. I mean, that was really and truly new. But, you know, thank you, Agent Fred, for the recommendation. But just to finish up with the Hanukkah edition of Prayer Meeting Wednesday, let's pop over to the Steadfast Baptist Church in Jacksonville, Florida. Yes, really. Brother Deacon Asa sent this one along. Adam Fannin, F-A-N-N-I-N, pastors, Steadfast, misspelled, by the way, Steadfast, Jacksonville Church. And toward the end of last month, he decided to explain Hanukkah to his mouth-walking, knuckle-breathing followers. Get the hockey puck.
Off into the feast tonight, but I just want you to keep that in mind as people will try to point you to certain feasts, and they will try to say, well, Purim and Hanukkah, well, that's not something that we're commanded to do. That is not something Jesus Christ did. He has fulfilled the beginning of what Moses taught, and I believe one day he will bring everything to fruition in the end times. Another major problem that we have with Hanukkah is the candlestick that they use. Now, biblically, the candlestick that they used had seven branches. It had seven parts coming off for seven lamps. And the Talmudic Hanukkiah, they call it, the candle bra, has nine. So what they use...
Wait, time out, Jack. Okay, time out. Candle bra? Candelabrum? Candelabra. But in either instance, because I'm in possession of the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language, I can assure you that a proper reference is not a candle bra. In fact, my sad, tortured mind, in which none of you ever want to live, is trying to gin up much to... I'm resisting, I promise... I'm guessing if I buy Agnes a candle bra for Christmas, it will not be well received. I mean, you know, with the uplift and the wires and the little thing that comes out and the little candle holder, candle bra. I know. Before I even said it, Alexander was right there with a candle bra. What? It's a candle bra. That's what it is. It's a bra for candles, or maybe it's a bra with candles in it. Oh, I don't know. At least Agnes isn't within earshot, so she won't know that I'm sitting here pondering. Well, never mind what. No, just don't. Now, what's it? Let's go back.
May be something that he will yet fulfill at his second coming when he returns to the earth. And, you know, I think the atonement may deal more with the judgment. But again, I don't want to get off into the feast tonight, but I just want you to keep.
He doesn't want to get off at the feast. I'm really hoping for all of our sakes that he doesn't. Well, he's not welcome. I can tell you already that Pastor Fannin is damned well not welcome in our fellowship hall with his candle bras and his getting off at the feast. He is. Alexander says, oh, my Lord, what an idiot. And Brother Deacon Asa says, yes, candle bra. Brother Fannin, works the art of word knowing into the sermons like Van Gogh worked the paintbrush. Paint candle bra.
Keep that in mind as people will try to point you to certain feasts, and they will try to say, well, Purim and Hanukkah. Well, that's not something that we're commanded to do. That is not something Jesus Christ did. He has fulfilled the beginning of what Moses taught, and I believe one day he will bring everything to fruition in the end times. Another major problem that we have with Hanukkah is the candlestick that they use. Now, biblically, the candlestick that they used had seven branches. It had seven parts coming off for seven lamps, and the Talmudic Hanukkah, they call it, the candle bra, has nine. So what they use for Hanukkah actually has nine. It does not have seven.
A bra with nine. Maybe it's for a cow or something. Udders? I mean, Lee in New York. Candle bra? It was used by the female popular music singer in the 18th century to shock the audience. And Ron in Raleigh says, really? You must be thinking of Liberace. These guys know so much about stuff they have no knowledge of. Yeshua was a Jew till the day he died. You're darn right he was.
Seven, as the Bible teaches. You're in Exodus 25. Look at verse number 32. And six branches shall come out of the sides of it, three branches of the candlestick out of the one side, and three branches of the candlestick out of the other side.
Now, this is a guy who would fuck up just trying to say Hava Nagila, which I probably just fucked up. But he's preaching a sermon on how the Jews are getting their own religion wrong. That's some privilege, that Christian privilege, evangelical privilege.
So we've got a stem in the middle with three branches on either side. Look at verse 37. And thou shalt make the seven lamps thereof. And he goes on and gives the description. So there's seven lamps total in the candlestick that you see in the Bible. Go to 1 Kings chapter 11. Now, the traditional Hanukkah, they call it, nine-point candlestick, has a hexagram on the base of it as well.
Oh, no, not a hexagram.
That's Satan's star. That is the star of the devil. They want to put a hex on you. They want to cause Christians to change everything they believe. Oh, it's Jewish fables? Well, I'll just soak that up. I'll take whatever you give me. And look, there are a lot of so-called Christians that are deceived today, and it's because of their own wicked heart. They're drawn away by their own lust. Rather than just read the Bible and understand plainly what it says in the book of John or Corinthians or Titus or Timothy, they want to, you got some new Jewish fable for me?
No, really. Evangelical Christianity is preaching that Jews bad. I thought we might have gotten past this, but no, he goes on to say that Hanukkah is a deception from hell. Yes, he does. Hanukkah is a deception, and I believe it's like a starter drug to get you interested into the Hebrew Roots movement. Hebrew Roots movement? It's something to, I'll do Christmas, I'll do Hanukkah too, we'll respect everybody. Well, I don't really have any respect for Hanukkah. I'm sorry, it's not of God. It's not a good thing. You know, you'd think the people who invented the deity would know what is and isn't of God. A lot better than, say, this bigoted freak. And along the way, yes, he said Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, because what's white evangelical Christianity without a little racism? Hanukkah and Kwanzaa are wicked holidays. They're unholy holidays. Holiday is holy day, so how can you have a... Oh, my head's hurting already. Hanukkah is a deception from hell. It's wicked. Now, this outfit that he heads, this Steadfast Church, is just a weekly exercise in hatefulness. But I got to admit, it's a little depressing. just like the rise of neo-Nazism is depressing. And if you wonder where it comes from, well, wonder no more. A member of Identity Evropa would have been perfectly happy seated in that church hearing that sermon. No doubt.
You want to give me, tell me what the moons mean and what the feasts mean and what the, and you know, I want to start being a Jew. Look, we're going to see more and more of this at the end times. Yeah. Judaism was hijacked in Jesus' time. I say this a lot, and I want you to remember it.
He says it a lot. That does not, however, mean that he has even the first freaking clue of what it is he's saying. Judaism was hijacked in Jesus' time. Well, here's our obligatory Star Trek reference. Clarence writes in, Candlebra. Bob, I wonder if he means 7 of 9 from Star Trek with the bra reference. You know, we've got to discern the spirits to find that out, Clarence. We do. Meanwhile, Matt in San Francisco says, this poor man has confused Madonna's bra and Liberace's piano prop. Talk about a couple of gay icons. P.S., note for all believers, us non-believers really don't give two shits about your fantasy world. Ta-da! But the larger problem here is when you run around saying that one faith's holidays are evil, yeah, well, that's the front end of some very, very bad things that historically we've watched happen. And I'm not up for version, God, I don't even know what number it would be considering European history. I'm not up for version, you know, 152.0. No, not even a little bit. So, happy Hanukkah, y'all. Jesus, this guy's a freak. And so I had no small amount of prayer meeting Wednesday stuff, but I think we did a passing fair job at here endeth the lesson, okay? Thus saith the Lord. The Lord. And again, a reminder: we got 480 bucks as far as fundraising goes this evening, and probably won't be mentioning that much more because I've been looking forward to this conversation. You may recall a few weeks back that my old college chum Dan Fisher joined us to talk a little bit of this and a little bit of that. He had recently undergone a heart transplant. Well, I thought it might be nice to check in with Dan again, see how his recuperation is coming, and see what other sorts of high points we might find along the way. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Hey, I'm all right. I was trying to call you before. I had a weak signal in my room, so not that this matters to your listeners at all.
We talk about this stuff all the time, weak signals, and right. It's an internet-based program, so it matters.
That is true. But anyway, let's proceed past that, and just first of all, just thank you so much for having me on again. It was a lot of fun the last time, and I was really happy with the results, and I was also happy that people seemed to actually enjoy the show.
I'm happy every time people seem to enjoy the show, believe me, because you know there are evenings when all I can do is crawl over into the corner and pull myself up into a sort of a fetal ball and suck my thumb. But when people enjoy it, well, you know.
Yeah, that's a bonus, isn't it?
Well, it is. You know, it proves that that I am, in fact, Bob Kincaid, perfectly adequate.
Yeah, that's what I told you the last time, and I've listened to your show a couple of times since, and I'd give you a beyond adequate at this point now.
Well, thank you very kindly, and I was pleased to see that friends of yours enjoyed it, and there were even some people who shared memories of those dim and misty days of thespian shenanigans up at Harvard on the Mon, where we...
Harvard on the Mon, yes, also known as West Virginia University, home of the Mountaineers.
Home of heartbreaking football programs since 1894.
Yeah, well, you know, you get what you pay for, and we probably pay, I got to be careful what I say, I guess, but we all...
No, you don't.
Well,
it's just us. There's nobody listening, Dan.
Not that I object to college athletes being paid, because I, in fact, am pro paying college athletes. And that is an opinion that I share with seriousness, that that the NCAA makes billions of dollars a year, and we're not even counting all the money that gets shifted back and forth between people betting on NCAA sports, and all of that money that's being churned out and handed over to people, and it's not being handed over to the people who are doing the actual work, which is the athletes. So I'm not of the mind that a scholarship in and of itself is proper payment for being part of a literal billion-dollar industry. I think they deserve a little more than that.
I'm with you. I'm with you every step of the way there.
Okay. So that's the first thing out of the way. I don't have a list, by the way, but I do have a few notes that I actually scrolled down. And the very first note at the top of my page... There are two notes. The first says, slow down, because the last time we spoke, I was just like a chipmunk on meth, I felt. And the other is, don't interrupt him, which I did a lot of last time. So it's like, if I could just, you know, keep those in my head, I think that maybe I'll try to still be entertaining and witty, but at the same time, I'll try to let you have a word in here and there and let you be witty, because I'm sure that's why people tune into the...
I'm a born straight man, Dan, so I mean there's really no problem here.
Yeah, I mean, what is Abbott without Costello? You know, you need a straight man. The Marx Brothers were funniest when Zeppo was hanging out with them on screen. You know, once he left the act, it just wasn't the same. You know, if you have only nuttiness and craziness, it gets tiresome. You need somebody to react to that.
Well, so, since we're now off into the wonderful world of comedy, there's nothing funnier than the straight man stuff that, say, John Cleese did with Monty Python. You know, his frustrated bureaucrat, you know what I'm talking about.
Very much.
In juxtaposition against the madness that the rest... was the heart and soul of the funny.
I will though fight you on one thing you just said, which you said there's nothing funnier, and there is one thing in the world funnier than John Cleese as a straight man, and that is Walter Matthau as a straight man. Because Walter Matthau can just stand there looking at somebody and it's funny. Case in point, if you've ever seen the Odd Couple movie,
there's
a scene in there where Felix, played by Jack Lemmon, is that they're in a diner together, and Jack Lemmon suddenly has a sinus attack, and he starts making this obnoxious honking sound.
The honk, yes.
And you know, it's like meh, meh, and all Walter Matthau has to do is say, "Stop it, will ya?" And you don't even pay attention to Jack Lemmon making noises out of his nose. It's all about Walter Matthau.
Okay, another Walter Matthau moment. And certainly not one of his greatest films, but it is a film that I enjoy.
It's not film in the same way that Fellini or Scorsese is. It's a filmed play, really. With but I love that movie.
But the Survivors.
Uh-huh.
Robin Williams, Jerry Reed, and Walter Matthau.
Uh huh.
I mean, what a cast!
It's a great cast.
And at the beginning of the film, Walter Matthau's gas station has been inadvertently blown up by Robin Williams.
That happens in movies a lot. I try to avoid gas stations because you just never know.
Right. So he's in the unemployment line trying to collect unemployment, but he finds out that he can't, and it's of course set in New York City, And so that it's it, and it's the late 70s, early 80s, and you know that gritty sort of cinema reality sort of, you know.
It was very big in the 70s to show New York as an absolute hellhole. And it probably was an absolute hellhole. By the time I arrived, it was a little more cleaned up.
And so he's sitting there, and a woman of Indian extraction is trying to help him. And she eventually says, "I am sorry, but I am terribly, terribly, terribly unable to help you." And Walter Matthau looks at her and deadpan says, "Lady, you can't treat people like cattle." Oh, sorry.
Oh, right. Cattle. India. Indian.
And just, again, delivered just as flatter than piss on a plate. And it guts you. It just guts you.
But anyway, my heart is fine, thank you. I'm still alive.
Well, that's where I wanted to. That was number one on my list, but I wasn't going to step on your list.
Especially when you get me talking about Walter Matthau. I mean, I could talk for 2 hours about that.
What is it? Give us the story of Dan. So since last we spoke, I mean, things are going well. The numbers are going in the right directions.
All of that. In fact, it gets frighteningly boring now. Like when people call. You know, people will call every now and then or text, you know, "Hey, how's it going, buddy? You know, hanging in there." And I can sense that I'm kind of boring them because I don't have anything really dramatic or thrilling to tell them. It's like, yeah, I'm walking outside now 30 minutes at a time. You know, it's really like your grandpa telling you about, you know, when he went to the mall and got a pair of shoes at the Payless. It's as steady as it comes. And, you know, I mean, that's good news. It means I'm not dying or dead. I'm still here and I'm doing well. I'm making progress. I'm down to a biopsy once every month. And eventually
I assume those are not pleasant.
They're not bad, really. They're not pleasant, but, you know, they lather me up with a lot of – it goes through – did I discuss this the last time? Probably not.
No, we didn't talk mechanics of biopsy.
Yeah, okay. The mechanics of biopsy, for those who really – this is, you know, who are into this stuff. Well, I mean, a lot of people watch medical shows, so this is sort of like a medical show on streaming radio and no commercials. Anyway, I get a biopsy once a month right now. And folks, what that's for is that they take little chunks of my heart flesh, tiny chunks of like the size of a grain of rice sort of thing, or even less, half a grain of rice. They take little chunks out of my heart flesh and then they do scientific things to it to check to see how my heart's doing.
It's alive.
They want to see if my body's rejecting the heart or not. That's the most important thing. I mean, having a heart is great, but keeping it in your body, that's even better. And so they test it for, among other things, to see, are there a lot of white blood cells gathered around these little chunks of flesh? That would be bad if that were true, because that means my body thinks that the heart is a disease and must be fought. And no, the answer has been, with everything, it's been zero sign of rejection. And that's number one. That's what my first 6 months of recovery from transplant are about, is just keeping the dang thing in my chest, without any ill side effects. And, you know, that's why I take a mountain of pills every day. And I'm very, you know, I'm lazy and undisciplined in a lot of ways in my life. But one thing I have been very disciplined about is making sure I take my meds and, you know, that's one of those, you know, secret little public service announcements I'm making within my speech, which is that just reminding any of your readers, your listeners who might be on.
We read too, Dan. It's okay.
I mean, I know you know more than I do, so you certainly must read something. But yeah, take your meds, folks. Whether it's for what's in your head or what's in your body. You know, you're not sticking it to the man by not taking them. And really, those people have medical degrees that were very expensive to obtain. So if you trust your doctor at all, just take what they tell you to take until until the time comes that you don't have to take it.
Indeed. Well, I'm glad to know the biopsies are going well, and hopefully, eventually the mountain of medicine will move more toward molehill. And I gotta tell you, Dan, thanks for doing this for me, by the way. It used to be that every time I saw Count Dickula, you know, Dick Cheney,
yes,
I would think, well, there goes that guy walking around with some decent human being's heart in his chest.
Right.
And it left a, well, I don't like the metaphor, but I'm stuck with it. It left a bad taste in my mouth. So there he was, cackling and giggling with Mike Pence today in the National Cathedral.
I saw your stuff on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah. And so I looked at him and instead of immediately just thinking, I thought, wait a minute, I've got a friend who got a heart transplant, and I'm really, really glad about it. So fuck you, Dick. You've no longer ruined heart transplants for me.
And the good news is that I couldn't tell you how many people are getting heart transplants a day or a month or a year. I'm so self-obsessed, I haven't looked up those numbers to see who else is getting them besides me. But I gotta have faith that there's a lot of people out there who you'll never know, who are more or less, I would imagine, good by any standard compared to Dick Cheney, at least. And they're getting hearts, too. And that's all because, again, and I nagged the hell out of your listeners the last time about it, but, you know, it's because people are donating and getting used to the idea that you can donate your organs once you no longer need them, and you'll save a life. And so even Dick Cheney, you know, I guess deserves to live, ? But if not necessarily Dick Cheney, a lot of other people out there do deserve to get hearts and livers and lungs. I got a, you know, because of your podcast, by the way, I got like at least a dozen requests for new Facebook friends who were listeners of your show. And one of them IM'd me to say that she had gotten lung transplants, which hadn't even occurred to me that you could do that. But of course you can. So it's everything's recyclable, I guess, and I'm glad for it. So, but and then just to finish out the adventures of my boring daily routine, I have a doctor's appointment coming up next week with my cardiologist, and if she gives the sign off, we will be close to the 3-month mark since the surgery, which could mean that I get to drive a car again, which is the first time I'll have done that in a year. Literally about a year ago in December, I went in for the first procedure, which was the pump, the LVAD that was attached to my heart. And once that was installed, I was told two things about motor vehicle transportation. One, I was not allowed to drive. And two, I have to sit in the back seat. Because if airbags go off, if a wreck happens and airbags go off, that could inhibit my LVAD or anything else's ability to keep pumping the blood through me. So because of that, since December of last year, I have been a passenger in the back seat, usually with my lovely wife Helene driving, or even like my kids when they're home. It's, you know, driving Mr. Daddy because I haven't been allowed. So that is something to look forward to, and that will be exciting when I can do that again. Just get in a car and go.
Do you have to be careful about things like adrenaline responses or stress responses that can run your heart rate up and stuff like that?
Because that's a good question. That's a good question that I had not occurred. It had not occurred to me because all I've been thinking of is just, holy cow, isn't it great I get to drive. And now you threw a little bit of a monkey wrench into my enthusiasm there. But that's okay. That's a very sensible question to ask that I will ask my doctor. I would imagine that.
I have a couple of times I've gone howling down. What is it? The FDR. And it made me. And I was just a passenger, and it was far more exciting than any roller coaster, I can tell you, Dan. It was.
It's the Daytona 500 out there. Yeah, I mean, I live in the suburbs of New York City, and even out here, sometimes people, you know, people get pretty ballsy in the mall parking lots, is all I can tell you. So
I don't think, now I just got back from Atlanta, and I don't think it's anything like Atlanta, where everybody down there is having their Earnhardt moment on the connector, and it hadn't changed when I was down. It had been 2 or 3 years since I'd been there before, but no, nothing's changed. And in some ways, it feels like traffic is safer when it's all jammed up and everybody's doing 5 miles an hour. Because there's just no room for the Earnhardts to really get their NASCAR on.
Okay, folks. Now that we've discussed traffic, I'm sure we'll be discussing weather.
Let's go to Bill in the traffic copter.
It's like visiting your parents or something. You get out of the car and you go up and you give the hugs and kisses, and the first thing your dad wants to know is what route you took and did you make good time and all of that. So let's avoid old man talk if we can.
Well, look, we started out with, because we are, Dan, we are, and we started out with health stuff. Luckily, we didn't get into any bowel issues. That's a bonus.
That's
and
a bonus.
We moved into traffic. We'll at some point in time we'll talk about the weather, and then somebody's going to mention bunions.
No bunions. Onions, yes. Bunions, no. Bowel movements. That'll be. You know, I'm always worried about what I'm going to talk about when I call in, or the second time. Always out of the two times, I'm always worried about what I'm going to talk about, and I always fear being boring. So I'll save the bowel movement talk for next week, but I'll give a little spoiler here. Bran, fiber.
Fiber is your friend.
Fiber is your friend. Anyway,
but you're in the greater New York area. Tell me, because I've seen some writing about it here and there, and of course, being the internet, there's no lukewarm. Everybody's either hot or cold, and what gives with this duck, the duck in Central Park?
The duck in Central Park is, first of all, you've seen the pictures because everybody has.
It's
right?
It's beautiful. But the first time I saw reference to it, it was Mandarin duck, and I'm thinking, well, this could be tasty.
No, it's not going to be available at your local, what is it, Panda Express.
No P.F. Chang's.
It's not only gorgeous, it's rare. And I don't mean cooked rare, because you should never cook any poultry rare. But nobody quite understands how this particular species of duck, from what I understand, showed up in Central Park. Now, I had promised you when you and I were talking a Mandarin duck story. And I will tell you that one of the photos that you might have seen was not only taken by a West Virginian, it was taken by a West Virginian that I grew up with, that I went to school with, that I met in fifth grade, a man our age named Phil McGrew. Phil has a photo of the Mandarin duck that has, as the kids call it, gone viral. And so viral, in fact, that it was just recently used during a Stephen Colbert thing on The Late Show, where he was talking about the Mandarin duck. And there up on the screen flashed Phil's picture of the Mandarin duck. And this is Phil McGrew from Middleburn, West Virginia. Phil is not a professional photographer. He just does it for fun. But every once in a while, well, a lot of the times, he does really striking works that get a lot of attention. And one of his photos of lightning striking over the Golden Gate Bridge, I believe, was published in National Geographic. So this is a guy who's not a professional, but just has a hell of an eye, or is extraordinarily lucky. But anyway, the Mandarin duck story with Phil is this. Stephen Colbert and Late Show does this little joke about the Mandarin duck, and there's Phil's image, and Phil posts on Facebook about how cool it is. And I, being the spoil sport that I am, and a couple other people too, you know, go back and say, hey, did they ask for the image rights for that? Did they seek clearances on that? And Phil's response was, they really didn't. They just kind of put it up there, and I have mixed feelings about it. So I, being in my field of props and working with television and show business stuff, I know that when you show an image on television, that is, especially for an entertainment program that makes lots and lots of money every single minute by advertisers, they have to reach out to you and pay you money and get your permission before they show that image. And so Phil and I went back and forth, and I actually found some old documents in my files from shows I worked on. Like, and I sent them, hey, here's a clearance form from CBS, you know, that shows that this is their usual way of doing it. And somebody over at Colbert kind of was sleeping on the job. And P.S., if they really, you know, if it was a matter of having to beat a deadline, you know, the pond is probably within a mile's cab ride from where they shoot the show to Central Park. So somebody could have gone over there and taken their own picture of the Mandarin duck, and they would have had the image rights for free, but they didn't. They'd used Phil's photo. And so the upshot, I'm happy to report, is that they offered him a fair sum of money and a deep apology. And so Phil's getting a nice dinner out of it. Nice. Yeah. And P.S., that very same image was on the front of accompanied with a New York Times story this week about how overblown the Mandarin duck situation has become. So this is something for those of us who are West Virginians, and certainly somebody like myself who knows him, grew up with him, and remembered riding on the bus to Arthur I. Borman Elementary School, just absolutely hating the place, and Phil did too. That's how we got to know each other, was our mutual detestation of our school and our fifth grade teacher, whose name I won't mention in particular. And now he's a big shot, you know.
I'm looking at the photo now, and there's a reason it's so popular. That photo is absolutely alive.
It is. Well, what's funny, it's the
one. And the New York Times credited him, by the way.
Yeah, they did. They did the right thing. They called him ahead of time and asked permission, and he gave it, you know. And that's the funny thing too. I think if Colbert had just called up and said, "Hey, can we do it?" They could have saved themselves a little bit of money, because Phil was just happy to have it on TV. But because somebody didn't do their job, you know, that's going to cost you a little bit. You know, that'll help you remember the next time. And plus, you know, you're standing up for others who could be in similar circumstances down the line. Everybody deserves to get paid a little something. I mean, I have a saying: nobody gets into show business to not make money. You know, even the guy, you know, cracking the eggs or peeling the potatoes for the crew, it deserves to be paid a good sum of money. That food's important to keep the crew going.
Yeah, that person may love their art, but you can't pay the power bill with art.
Right, exactly. But anyway, speaking of overblown things, first of all, I haven't done this yet, and I should, and I'll get to the overblown thing. I would like to thank all of your listeners for listening, and to wish them happy holidays. It is the, I believe, the fourth night of Hanukkah, and of course we know the big one with Santa is coming up, Christmas, and so you know that's on people's minds. And I don't know if you saw, by the way, there is a Hanukkah in West Virginia song that's starting to catch on a little.
No, really? Are there banjos?
There are no banjos. He has kind of you remember Rupert Holmes, the guy that did the Pina Colada song?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
You might not remember him. But yeah, it has that kind of Rupert Holmes sound where it's just him at a piano, and he's got this kind of mellow, it's Hanukkah in West Virginia. He's got this kind of mellow sound. But the song is about how being a Jew in West Virginia can be kind of isolating. You know, you go into Walmart, and there's not a lot of stuff. There's no sale on potato pancake mix.
There's no potato pancake mix.
There probably is not. I did know some Jews in West Virginia. I didn't know the town.
I know several.
When I went to summer camp, I met my first Jews from Wheeling, West Virginia. So I'm assuming there's some population. But I'm the only non-Jew in my particular household, by the way.
You might find it interesting, Dan. This is just a little bit of trivia, but way back, say, long about 2004 or so, Mel Gibson moved his daddy into a little house over in Somersville, West Virginia, about 20 miles north of me.
I thought his father was a well-known anti-Semite.
He was, and he moved to West Virginia because. There's no, because, and this is very nearly a quote, There's no Jews there because everybody in West Virginia has to work.
Oh, well, we don't know if that's actually true. Let's be fair to Mel Gibson for once. I mean, I love Road Warrior anyway, but maybe that's true. How do we know that story is true?
Sounds direct quote.
Oh, okay. So screw Mel Gibson if that's true.
No, that was what his daddy said. There's no, but Mel moved him here because daddy wanted to be here because
there's no Jews. Well, there are some Jews. I'm sure it's not.
Just down the mountain from me, down in Charleston, there's a Temple B'nai Hillbilly.
Oh, did I lose you?
No, I'm right here.
Oh, I got a little cracky for a minute.
No, it'll drop out from time to time. It's the miracle of Skype. But yeah, that was a failed joke anyway. Just down the mountain is in Charleston is Temple B'nai Hillbilly, but
that's a joke.
Yeah, a very bad one.
Ah, no. There are no bad jokes, only bad people who tell jokes. What you need is a good guy with a good joke. I don't know.
Is that from the National Risible Association, the NRA?
You got me there. Risible. That's a word I only use when I'm doing crossword puzzles.
I was just looking for an R word meaning laughter that I could turn into NRA.
Hey, that's a faster gun than I got there. Anyway, to any who may or may not be Jewish who are listening, truly, happy holidays and happy Hanukkah to you. And you are not forgotten, either in West Virginia or in New York, certainly, and certainly not in my heart. We do in the Fisher household, because again, my wife is Jewish and my two kids by extension are considered Jewish. And I think to some extent they identify as that. What we do at Hanukkah is we have our ceremony is we have a menorah and we light it. And then instead of exchanging presents or little gold coins or frying up the potato pancakes, all we simply do is say happy Hanukkah and then we do a group hug. And that's it. Then it's done. And then we let the candles melt out and we move on with our night, I should say. We don't do the why is this night any different or any of the other stuff. But, you know, we give the effort and we love each other. And so any chance you get to hug your wife and your kids, yeah, I'm all for that. But I did promise you, by the way, to make fun of something or discuss something overblown. And I'm curious of your thoughts, and maybe you've discussed it on the show already.
Okay.
The baby, it's cold outside controversy. Where do you stand on this, Bob Kincaid? Do we need to set that up? Does anybody not know about
it? It probably begs a setup. Baby, It's Cold Outside has been banned from holiday Christmas music playlists.
I will tell you right now, as far as I know, or at least a couple of days ago, the word would be playlist. A single station in Cleveland.
Yeah, Cleveland. Okay, right. Yeah.
And it from its playlist. So,
but here, because the lyrics are kind of creepy and rapey.
Yes.
And I fear I'm diminishing by saying, using the word kind of in front of rapey.
There's such a controversy.
It's an uncomfortable, if you're paying attention, it's an uncomfortable song. The thing is, I saw that controversy, Dan, in the larger context of music generally and rock and roll in particular.
Because
it just so happened I was somewhere earlier today where Ringo Starr singing "You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine" came on.
It was actually an old song by I don't know who did it first, but that was an old 50s or 50s
yeah, was
song.
It Jerry Lee Lewis maybe? But
no, it was a black person, dude.
Was it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It was somebody on the Atlantic label. But I, you know, it could have been like Melvin Johnson and the Doo-Woppers or something like that. I don't know. It was.
But the larger point is if one, this could spell the end of rock and roll as we know it, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. This is the thing too. You know, the rapey vibe, you know, which is, hey, what's in this drink? And the whole time she's saying no, and he's going, yeah, but you don't really mean no. Come on over here and sit on my lap. Now, of course, you know, I have disliked this song for a long time, and that's part of it. The second reason for me of disliking it is it's one of many Christmas songs that really aren't Christmas songs at all. They're just talking about cold weather and making out. You could sing this song in February. It still has the same relevance. It's cold outside. I better go. No, it's cold. You know, stick around for a while. It has, you know, there's not even like snowmen. There's, you know, it's so to me, that's not a Christmas song. But yeah, I always thought of it as the rapey vibe from way back. Like, I think even as a kid, you know, the same way that even as a kid, I didn't really like the Pepe Le Pew cartoons a whole lot. You know, that whole you're saying no, but you're really yes, don't you? You know, it never caught on as particularly cute or hilarious to me. Now, I have a friend who went to WVU in the theater department who got in on this with me on Facebook. I'm like, I am becoming like your parents because I keep talking about stuff I see on Facebook, not Twitter, not Instagram, Facebook. But anyway, my friend who is a feminist came to the defense of Baby, It's Cold Outside. She says that if you know the history of the song, it was written by, I forget who, some famous songwriter, like of the Tin Pan Alley pop music standard type of thing. And he and his wife co-wrote this song and would sing it at their Christmas parties as like a laugh. And that supposedly it's not really about what you think it's about. And, you know, and she explained it to me and it kind of made sense to me. But I countered back with like, look, if every song like that came with a sheet providing context, maybe, you know, like if Brown Sugar came on by Rolling Stones and it said, you know what this really is, it's really identifying with the African-American slave or African slaves who, you know, and if you really listen closely, you can see that, you know, John Lennon isn't talking about abusing a woman when he sings about, you know, babe, I'm going to, you know, hunt you down or whatever. You know, run for your life as fast as you can. He's actually, he's prosecuting himself and punishing himself for his own bad tendencies. You know, okay, maybe if every song came with an explainer, we could forgive a lot of stuff. But all I know is that, you know, the very first time I heard it, I as a kid, I thought, I don't like this, and I still don't like it, and I think it's very easy. It's very easy to misrepresent when people just say what they mean. So when you kind of code it and try to have context, forget it. It's going to obviously be misrepresented as, oh, it's really cute and, you know, and yeah, ha, 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 you know, she wants to go and he won't let her and all he wants is to have sex. It's, isn't that, you know, and she really wants it if you come right down to it, you know, because she says in the 16th verse, she finally relents a bit. It's like no. I'm not gonna buy it. And you know, it's not. But the thing is too, is the overblownness part is because I don't like it. I am not one of those quote unquote politically correct people that thinks you have to then ban it, you know, and never hear of it again. You know, I just think all I have to do is not listen to it. Or if I go into a store and it's on in Target, I just try to ignore it and know that it eventually is going to end.
But the ban has expanded, by the way.
Has it? Okay.
Yeah. KOIT 96.5 here, San Francisco's Bay Area home of holiday music. They've banned it. As is KOSI 101.1, Colorado, Denver's holiday station. They've banned it, too.
Okay, but let's even look at the word ban. Is it really banning it, or they're just saying, we're not going to play that? You know, we don't like that song. You know, we don't like what it seems to say. We're not going to put it on our station that we own. I mean, are we saying that we're going to ban The Streak because they don't play it? No, because it hasn't been on anybody's playlist in 40 years. Are we going to ban Seasons in the Sun? I'm going to do only 1970s references here. Or, you know, we're going to ban the
But if you want to roll back around to my theory that this could mean the doom of rock and roll. It would not break my ass if people would quit. Would never, ever, ever again play Nick Gilder's "Hot Child in the City."
There's a lot of them, you know. I mean, and this is a second Facebook-related anecdote I have to share, which is that another Facebook friend of mine posted a thing with like a picture of Chris Rock making a funny face, and it was like a mean thing, right? And it said, "You all going to tell me that you want to ban Baby It's Cold Outside, and yet you listen to rap music?" And my reply was this. It's like, look, any song that talks about, you know, punishing women or treating them solely as objects to have sex with, yeah, I'm not going to like that stuff, you know, whether it's pop music or hip hop. But on the other hand, are you going to tell me that all hip hop is solely about abusing women? Because it's not true at all. If you believe that, it means you obviously haven't listened to any hip hop or what you call rap in about 10 to 15 years. You know, I got kids. My kids are 21 and 18. I don't turn to Spotify and listen to hip hop all the time, but I do catch it because I hear what they hear.
Right, you're getting it by osmosis.
Exactly. And I'm not talking about, oh, you know, some one single woke artist that you find. No, I'm talking about big selling artists like Cardi B, Kendrick Lamar, Frank Ocean, even, you know, even Kanye, batshit Kanye stuff. You know, for the most part, it's not about abusing the bitches. It's about raising the consciousness of people who have not had power, a.k.a. the people listening to the music, a.k.a. African Americans. This music's for you, and it's saying you can have power, you can have voice, you can, and also, you know what, you can raise hell. I'm not going to say like, oh yeah, I listen to hip hop all the time, and I know what's really happening. I don't. I'm 54 and I'm white, and I grew up on the fabulous sounds of the 70s and so forth. But yeah, I do listen by osmosis, and what I get from it is that this is the voice of people who need a voice. Who refuse to be ignored anymore, and you know what? There's a lot of money to be made from hip hop, and it's affected culture, art, not just music, but all of pop culture and all of culture period by being so omnipresent that it will not go away. And so again, to pretend that it's only about abusing women or treating women as objects to be, you know, have sex with, that's a 1992 perspective, and I'm not denying that it's still out there. Of course it's still out there, but you know what, as you say, so is it in turn to classic rock. Listen to Led Zeppelin, listen to the Stones, listen to anybody that you really like a lot, the Beatles. There's a lot of misogyny in that, and this is something that we have to come to as members of the audience. What are we willing to let slip because we love it and or we enjoy it? And what are we willing to forgive? And what if we feel a little creepy and hypocritical forgiving that? Look, I used to believe that the funniest movie of all time, counting Marx Brothers and Some Like It Hot, number one on my list was National Lampoon's Animal House. I thought that was pound for pound, that movie made me laugh from beginning to end, even more than Airplane, which was probably number two. But now, I won't watch it, and it's not that I'm banning it. Honestly, Bob, I'm afraid of it. I'm afraid of watching Animal House because I'm afraid of disappointing myself that I once thought it was really hilarious that Bluto leans a ladder up against a house and watches a woman be naked and fondle herself. You know, I mean, it could still, you know, we could go in many directions with just discussing that particular scene. But the thing is that it's not consent. And if it happened, if it were your house and there were a ladder and somebody were watching your wife or your daughter or you, you would not find that so hilarious. And the same with the original movie MASH, the Robert Altman MASH.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with the walls of the shower coming down and...
and just the way they treat women. It's yeah. I'm afraid to watch that. And I love that movie.
Well, okay, so let's turn this to something a little more... granted, it was a period piece, but a little more contemporary. How much cringing did you do during Mad Men?
How much cringing did I do?
Yeah.
You mean for the way the women were treated?
Yeah.
Not that much, but I didn't do like, I don't think I did sort of fantasizing that I was Don Draper. It's funny you mention that because in my Facebook thing tomorrow, I post this daily thing about my life as seen through the eyes of having watched a certain television show.
I've enjoyed the heck out of those, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, tomorrow happens to be about dun-da-da, Mad Men. So I kid you not, because it's the year 2008. We're up to 2008 now in the series. We started in 1967. So I'm going to discuss that, but I can discuss it with you now, too, which is that as the show goes on, I think the women get more powerful in that show.
Well, I think they do, because it's a function of the passage of time and the changing of a social dynamic.
Right.
As reflected in the theming, in the themes and the scripting of the program.
And you know that I think that Matt Weiner, I don't think he set out to make it like a, hey, you know, everybody, he didn't make it like a James Bond movie, where when Don Draper has sex with the beautiful stranger out of nowhere, that the first thing, well, maybe the first thing you think is, yeah, that's really cool, I would like to have sex just with a gorgeous woman who propositions me. I mean, that's a male fantasy, and that could be a woman's fantasy too. But Don never gets away scot-free in those things. Don is never shown as there's not a whole lot of post Oh James moment in bed where she's stroking his chest hair. Usually at some point there are consequences to his serial cheating. That's a terrible word, but that's what it is. So I don't know, do I cringe? No, I never cringed at it. The same way, I mean, I think that Weiner really wanted to depict the era accurately, and the warts,
well,
and all.
And that is why I asked the question, because if you are going to deal with a particular temporal context, you have to be honest about what that context was.
Right. Right. And so it does go back to the thing I was discussing of, can I watch something that I enjoyed once and not feel, you know, guilty as hell about it? I don't know. And this is just me. You know, every one of us who turn on a show or buy a movie ticket, we're each, you know, we're going in alone in many ways. We're going in to accept a story. And whether or not you are offended, and I get really tired of that word, offended, like, oh, you're offended. No, you can be offended. Something can piss you off. You know, people get offended every day about all kinds of things.
And sometimes art's supposed to do that.
That's true, too. And in some ways, I'd rather be offended. I'd rather watch Clockwork Orange than a Jennifer Aniston romantic comedy from the 90s, because one gets one interests me. One gets my emotions going, and the other is just as exciting as watching a bowl of pudding set, you know, and I'll leave you to guess which one is which. But yeah, I don't know. I think a lot about these things. And the answer for me is I don't have an opinion yet. I don't have a settled opinion. Like, so many people online just seem so certain of themselves, you know, this is black, this is white. And maybe it makes me milquetoast to say, well, it could be this or that. But the fact is, I am a white man in his 50s. And so mine is the default reaction to a lot of things in life. You know, people pay attention to the way I react and the things I say, partly because they assume I have worthy things to say and think about, because I'm a white man in his 50s with gray hair. It's a little harder if you're not. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a little harder. We all know this is true. Well, I wish we all knew this was true. Anyway,
well, acknowledging the privilege is the starting point.
Yeah,
and you're talking about privilege,
And that my mind can be changed with a good argument or a good example. You know, I don't really feel my opinions are set in stone. And does that make me wishy-washy Charlie Brown, or does that make me an accepting, considerate person? Depends who you ask.
Whether you meant to or not, you've kind of moved the, at least for me, and you'll see why, moved the conversation over into a slightly more political space, and that is this, that, you know, the recent funeral of, well, today, what happened today? One, I kind of despise living in a world where whatever happens has to be compared. It has to be some sort of a standard whereby we judge how awful Donald Trump is by his inability to conform to those standards. I mean, the fidgeting at the funeral today, for instance.
But, yeah, and his not reading the. I'm not Catholic. I don't know what the thing is called.
The Apostles' Creed. Protestants read it too. Presbyterians, Lutherans, they all read it. Yeah.
Very wrong and offensive. And then people would have banned me from your show. Yeah, the Apostles' Creed. I'm sorry. Go on. Go on what
well,
you were going to say.
So that's. Okay, let's say bothersome. I'm sick to death, Dan, of this is a struggle of because this is what I do, and a lot of times since January the 20th, 2017, I've come on the air talking about the latest Trumpian outrage, and sometimes I just try not to talk about that guy just because I need a damn break. It's so dysfunctional. But to move into the realm of the funeral itself, I've said a lot of things about George H.W. Bush over the years, and there were a lot of things I disagreed with, and there are a lot of things that the Bush family has done that I have disagreed with and found odious. But and I don't know if I would have said this 15 years ago when I was coming back to radio. But In the interim space of those 15 years, I have lost a father.
Me too.
And I know what that feels like. And so no matter how much I despised George W. Bush for all the truly awful things he did as a president, and they were truly awful, when he broke up, when he was eulogizing his father, I recognized within myself that pain.
Right.
And it was a human moment.
Right.
But at the same time, I know that out here in the part of this political spectrum where I operate, there's, well, fuck him, you know, he deserved to hurt that bad. What about the million people that he killed and the million innocent or the civilians he killed in Iraq? And that's valid.
You know what? It's your response is yours based on your particular experience, right? And your particular convictions. Fuck that guy, but he's dead, and it's a funeral. Just sort of maybe keep your mouth shut out of respect. That's basically been my response. But again,
not necessarily respect for them, but respect for myself.
But we don't have the perspective of, for instance, being gay. I don't think neither. I know that I'm not, and I don't believe you are.
No.
Now, he wasn't as horrible as Reagan in terms of totally ignoring and choosing not to fund AIDS research and really, you know, trying to villainize homosexuals. But on the other hand, H.W. Bush didn't do a whole hell of a lot for them either. And certainly didn't help forward the cause of AIDS research. Not surprisingly, his son did, but that's a whole other story. But again, if I were a gay man, if I were HIV positive, I would say fuck that guy too. I'm going to say what I'm going to say. And also, it's in response to the other side of it, and including those who have been critics of him, who suddenly have been he was a nice guy and he was a pleasant guy and he wasn't as bad as Trump because, you know, anybody looks like Abraham Lincoln compared to Trump.
Well, yeah, but isn't that something to worry about in this country that now the standards are not as bad as opposed to some sort of dispassionate measurement of was he good?
Yeah. You know, it will be something especially worthy of worrying about in 2020 and beyond that. I think politics themselves, the campaigning and how politics are communicated to people, I think all of that has changed because of Trump, because he's changed the way the medium is, you know what I'm saying. He's using he's using Twitter. He's going to these love me rallies, and it's all about emotion. And truth is no longer truth, etc. And, you know, I don't want to go too far down the political rabbit hole, even though I respect that this is a political show. But again, this goes back in a way to what we're talking about with whether or not I find Baby It's Cold Outside offensive or not. It doesn't matter in a way. I'm one listener out of millions and millions of listeners. And if I were, you know, if my dad had been killed in the first Iraq war, and I believed that that war was unnecessary and a waste of my father's life, I might feel differently than Bob Kincaid or Dan Fisher about it. I might, again, say, fuck that guy. Or I might say it in response to CNN going on and on about what a sweetheart he was. And there's Bob Dole saluting him and stuff. Now, my father died, too. And by the way, I'm sorry that you lost your dad.
Thanks.
You know, so I understand that pain. And I've just chosen – I personally have chosen to be silent about – on one side or the other, about either, you know, overpraising him or attacking both Bush or Trump, for that matter. It is true in terms of the Apostles' Creed thing and the not singing along to the hymn when everybody else was, that if you're going to court the evangelical vote and pretend that you're a Christian, you might want to put a little more effort into it. You know, you might want to – this is – you know, of course the camera's going to be on you, and here's a chance – you know, because I don't believe he's gone to church at all since he's been elected. Even like Easter or Christmas, he goes to Mar-a-Lago. And that's it's the people's business to go to Mar-a-Lago. But him not going to church, I don't care about any more than, you know, if a candidate were to say, well, I'm an atheist. I don't care. Can you do the job? Can you get my 401k back up to being profitable this year? Can maybe we not have these silly tariff wars that are not easy to win? I don't know. For me, I'm staying silent on the Bush thing. I'm keeping with posts about comic strips and movies and TV shows when I go on Facebook, because it's not something I really have a lot of passion about.
History is gonna do what history does. And history will pass its judgment. You know, there's no one monolithic history, but it's already being written to a certain extent.
Well, it's being manipulated to an extent.
It's also very much being manipulated. But I just felt like maybe, well, there's a line from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock where T.S. Eliot says, there will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. And, you know, that's a face for another day. It would have been nice, I think, if somewhere along the way, but no, you can't expect that of the millionaire for-profit media, that they're going to say, well, you know, let's do a 30-minute roundtable now, on the Willie Horton ad, but first this message from our sponsors.
Yeah, it's still about money. I mean, you know, news is part of show business, and the way it's all changing too. The news is no longer the news. The news is tailoring content to meet what people want to read, and it's not just Fox, baby. You know, I mean, HuffPost does it. CNN does do it. You know what? I go to CNN.com every day, and I'm getting a little tired of the, you know, let's pile on to Trump this time thing. And there's plenty to pile on about. But at the same time, when you give that much space over to did he sing or not sing or did he pray or not pray, that's one less column you could be writing about, you know, North Carolina trying to stifle, you know, votes, or, you know, Wisconsin, you know, doing a Republican coup for the incoming Democratic administration. There's lots of things you could be talking about. But the fact is that and the Mandarin duck and Baby It's Cold Outside and the Bush funeral, those things all bring about clicks, and it's all about clicks now. I mean, that's the funny thing too about the people I've seen who try to engage politically on the other side, let's say. They'll do this thing about when you inevitably get into that old take off the tinfoil hat and stop watching Fox, they'll count. Well, you need to stop watching MSNBC and CNN, as if we are glued to the set all the damn time like the average Fox viewer is. I think, I don't know. I know for myself that I don't ever turn on the television to watch news. I get what I get. I go online and I scroll around to all different kind of places, BBC, or clicks through Facebook and oh, you know, that's an interesting take. Let me click to that. And it's all about click, click, click. Mandarin Duck, I want to see that. You know, Baby It's Cold Outside, who's sputtering nonsense about that now? And meanwhile, somebody's making money because I clicked. And they're, you know, and then because of that too, because I have to do my outrage about, you know, rap music being, you know, unfairly labeled as misogynistic exclusively, because I had to vent that, somebody got information about me that they're going to use to put a commercial my way that's directed toward my supposed interests. It's all a big racket, and we are now part of the show. You know, our responses to things have become the entertainment in and of itself. You know, very few of us are famous for it, but we're all participating in
this.
Well,
we are the liquid asset that fuels their fire.
Yeah,
because no data, no profitability.
Right.
But, by the way, I just thought you'd Darlene in Connecticut.
Hi, Darlene.
Just wrote in and said, don't forget W's issue with stem cell research. Set the science back years on religious grounds, which was upsetting as someone with a genetic disease who isn't religious. Yes, it was W's perspective, but it bootstrapped, for lack of a better term, others such as myself who had and still maintain a different perspective. Where do you draw the line?
You know what, Darlene? You have an absolute right to post anything you want online saying fuck that guy, and whether or not I or anybody else or Bob Kincaid says, oh, maybe we should lay off him, let's stop politicizing a funeral. You know what? You have the full right to feel that, because if I were in your shoes, I sure as shit would. How about that? I cursed.
But good, I would. For, good for
Seriously,
you.
I would,
good for you.
I would feel that way too. And I'm sorry. Whatever.
Wait a minute. You've thrown a couple of fuck that guys at. I don't think you get a participation trophy for using the brown word.
My friend Victor, by the way, listened to the first show, and he texted me, you cursed a lot more on that show than you do in real life. And I wonder if it's just because it is online, so I can, you know. If this were on video, I might start taking off my clothes, God help us all. Just because I can't. Darlene, seriously, I'm sorry, whatever issue you have, I am sorry. I hope you're still with us, and I'm glad of that. And yeah. The Bush administration and all Republican administrations have been terrible about advancing stem cell research. And if I knew more about it, I could go on more about it. But and that's what I get back to with my particular medical malady, is that when I was in the hospital, you know, and I was hyped up on meds and very, very sensitive to everything I felt and everything I heard. And this was in the midst of the Me Too Kavanaugh stuff. Like while I was in the hospital, while I'm lying in bed, you know, high on prednisone, everybody around me was arguing Kavanaugh and the hearings, and it was, I was in the middle of this tinderbox, and I just wanted to keep calm. I'm a heart patient with a 3 or 4 day old heart in my chest, so it's like, don't get involved.
And there's no fun in a prednisone buzz.
No. But as I told you the last time, I would like cry at the drop of a hat. I got angry super easily, and I knew all of this was not good to keep the heart rate down and to keep the blood pressure down. So I really tried to be involved intellectually and feel what I felt, but at the same time not get super, super angry and not get into the back and forths and rabbit hole of the whole thing, because I knew at that time for me that was no good physically. You know, I'm no good as a voter if I'm dead. So don't. Keep the blood pressure, keep the heart rate down.
Speaking of which, on election day, did you do as you had predicted and went and voted in person?
I did, with my mask on, and they had no problem with that, which I was all ready to, like, you know, stir up a conflict, you know. But in New York, they don't do the whole, you know, you have to produce 20,000, you know, types of ID. And plus I'm white, so they weren't going to buck me too much on my voter thing. But in New York, I don't think that's an issue either way. But anyway, yes, I voted. I voted pretty much as you expected. And after you and I talked, I did go online. I did do a little more research about about the candidates. I didn't just go, well, I'm Democrat, so I'm just going to just dink, 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 dink. No, I tried to learn a little of what's going on, and I thank you for that. But the point I was going on about being in the hospital and in the midst of the Kavanaugh thing and being on Facebook at that time, because you're lying in bed, what else are you going to do? I was on a lot, and certainly a lot of my Facebook friends, especially women, you know, had very strong opinions of what was going on. And even some of the ones who were, you know, their opinion was not the ones I would want them to have, let's just say, about the whole situation. But I realized that if I'm going to be better, to paraphrase our First Lady, if I'm going to be better, I have to listen more in my life. I can't just work on fortifying my opinions and finding links that verify that I'm correct and proving that, you know, this person or that person is the better person. No, I have to just listen. And again, I hope that doesn't come off as wishy-washy. But especially if it's an issue about women, I'm going to listen when a woman speaks up. And I got into it today with a friend who's a committed Bernie head. And I don't know where you stand on Bernie. I have mixed feelings. I would certainly vote for him against Trump. I didn't vote for him in the 2016 primary. Was that a mistake? I don't know. But I didn't then.
And I did down here, and he carried all 55 counties in West Virginia.
Okay.
But then I recognized all along that it was an uphill climb and a long shot.
But
and
yeah.
Then when he did not get the nomination, I did what I have always been taught to do, at least through my studies of the American political process, and I went and voted the person whose values were nearest mine and who had a chance of winning, because there's only two potential winners in any presidential contest, at least, it's presently constituted.
I think my one particular friend, and he sent me a bunch of links, and I doubt he'd be listening. But if you are Tom, I've read some of them. I will read them. I'm not anti-Bernie. I have mixed feelings. I've grown up a moderate Democrat. Now is the time for the moderate Democrat over? Maybe. I don't know. If you haven't caught on by now, I evolve my opinions, and that is sometimes not respected by people who are so certain that they're correct that they're going to throw 50 links at you if you dare disagree. And I'm not even saying they're wrong. Their conviction might be just the thing this country needs. And my wishy-washiness might be something that's out of date. And I better grow a backbone and stand firm on my beliefs and et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, my friend who's the Bernie, I'm not going to say Bernie bro. He's not a bro, but committed Bernie person. And we got into it at one point online about Bernie's appeal to African Americans. And he threw all these things at me and all these things. And I countered with, well, I did read this article where he said this thing on Martin Luther King Day that got a lot of black people upset. And he sent me more things, proving that I was wrong. But my point is this, if black people are upset about it, and I don't know if it was just an article I read or a number of articles, but I read this one particular article about it, where there were a number of African Americans who were upset about some things that Bernie had said on Martin Luther King Day. And it wasn't just the story. There were links to the story that I read that seemed to bear this out. And the comments section, you know, seemed to bear this out, that he's got to do a better job of reaching out to those people. And those people being the people who carried our water as the Democratic Party in this midterms. If it weren't for African American voters, and specifically women African American voters, we would not have
this blue wave would not have happened.
And we're taking their concerns for granted. And so my thing is, I want to listen to those people, and I don't care about so much about the statistics and the articles that you're going to prove to me that it's all propaganda, that Bernie's not connecting or that anybody's not connecting or not connecting. If I want to know what the people that are the subject of the supposed controversy, what do they think, you know? And again, I'm not going to make one article or
well, where
an entire race.
Where 2020 is concerned, I've already staked my position. I don't want any, as far as the Democratic nominee in 2020 is concerned, Dan, I don't want any septuagenarians. I don't want septuagenarian Jesus H. Christ. Something happened. You must have muffled your mic or something.
Bernie will be almost 80 years old.
Yeah, but hey, Dan, your audio has just gone to hell. You're really, really.
Oh, I moved. Is it any better now?
Yeah, you're back. You're back to normal.
Okay.
Right. I want somebody vigorous, and I want somebody, who I don't have to worry about dropping dead in office of old age.
Yeah. Now, again, it's 2 years to 2020. So a lot's going to happen between now and then. I'm not even going to say can. I'm going to say will happen. I mean, you got to remember that, you know, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, those guys sort of came from the back of the horse race, and they got across the line first, inevitably. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm willing to keep my options open for damn near anybody. You know, sell me, convince me that you're right, convince me that I'm wrong, and get me on your side.
Yeah, well, in 2020, I'm voting for the Democratic nominee. Period.
Oh yeah.
it's more of a list of people I'm not particularly enamored of at
right.
this point in time, and given the vicious division that happened to the Democratic Party in 2016, there are two names I do not want to hear at all, and that's Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a damnation of either of them. It's just that I can't take another season of scab pulling, because that's what we had. The hardcore burners and the hardcore hilarians were just picking at each other.
And listen, you know, Bernie's impressed me. You know, I mean,
well, there's a lot to like. I mean, that's why I supported him.
Yeah, but I know what you're saying. There's a stridency there that's very off-putting, and there are moderates, and we don't have to vilify the moderates. Like, if you're not, you know, if we can't be the Democratic version of rhinos. You know, we can't only accept the we can't exclude those who are not true believers. And
frankly, my values align arguably more closely to Bernie than they do to the so-called pragmatists or the centrists,
uh-huh.
insofar as I firmly believe that it is not the privilege but the right, and this sort of brings us back to some of the stuff that you've dealt with, because you were so clear in saying that you would have been screwed had it not been for the fact that you had excellent health care because you're a union right. member. I'm so radical, Dan. I want everybody who gets sick in America to be able to go to the doctor. I want everybody in America who needs a new heart to have a fighting chance at getting a new heart.
And listen, I might still be screwed, you know, because if the pre-existing condition aspect goes away, who's to say that my healthcare provider won't say, you know what? If we don't have to pay for that, why should we? We can keep ratcheting up the profits by knocking that one off. And good luck, Mr. Fisher, on Medicare. And who knows if they'll even be Medicare. So, you know, I'm not out of the woods personally. And so, yeah, I've got to look out for my interests. And I have to know what my interests are and who's fighting for them. And it just it's never, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, I try to be open to both parties. It's like, well, just look at consistently, at least in my lifetime, who's been on your side for your interests. Now, I'm not I am a working guy. I'm a union member. And so I believe it's the Democratic Party. Now,
I mean, right. I mean, there are a few things that I can just tick off on my fingers. Healthcare access for everybody. Not just access, healthcare for everybody.
Right.
Make it, and this goes back to some issues that had real promise at the beginning of Barack Obama's first administration, but were murdered in the Senate by Mitch McConnell.
Right.
Make it easier for Americans to join unions. And three issues that are referred to as environmental, but which, being in the midst of them, of one of them here in West Virginia, I do not see as environmental, but I see as a matter of fundamental human rights. because if you're poisoning the places where people live, it's not that you're making it less lovely for them to live there. You are making it less likely they will be able to stay alive there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I know that you're very, you've always been very active and very vocal in issues specifically affecting West Virginia in terms of mountaintop removal and what's going on with the, you know, with the water supplies after fracking and so forth. You know, just the utter destroying of our homes, well, my home state. You adopted it, but it's tragic that people are willingly, you know, selling out their futures for pennies on the dollar. And continuing to ignore any other industry besides the ones they know and are comfortable with for being something that can save them. There are other industries besides coal and fracking, and coal especially. It's dying, folks. I don't say that with joy. It's not the most efficient, profitable means of generating electricity and other forms of fuel. So because of that, companies are not using coal. They're just not. No matter what Trump tells you, coal usage goes down and down and down, and more electrical plants.
But Dan, just for the sake of accuracy, coal usage continues to rise throughout the planet. It's going down and down and down in terms of electricity generation, but that's largely because it's being replaced with frack gas, which is just a different devil. For instance, when they blow up a mountain here in West Virginia, a lot of that coal gets on boats and goes to places like the Netherlands, you know, Europe, where they're serious about climate change. But the Netherlands burns literally boatloads of mountaintop removal coal, or it gets on a boat and it goes to China. The Great Barrier Reef in Australia is a lot dead, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that coal barges out of Australia transit the Great Barrier Reef, and it's proven to be hell on that ecosystem. I see mountaintop removal, you know, West Virginia, Appalachia is the cradle of climate change in the Western Hemisphere. And I feel like Appalachia deserves something for all the sacrifices. You know, 100,000 dead working people over the course of a century, roughly 10,000 people a year.
Uh-huh.
There's got to be some payback for that. There's got to be, well, you know, like Willie Loman's wife says at the end of Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid.
And again, I can sympathize with anybody, you know, and I know people, and you probably do too, that, you know, they're not doing so good economically. They haven't for a long time. The state has not done well. I mean, that's the thing too. It's not like when I was growing up, it wasn't like coal miners were driving around in Cadillacs. It was a dirty, hard business. It's always been, you know, and so it's not like, you know, there was this great prosperity when I was growing up. People were poor all around me. And those were people that sometimes they even had jobs, because you didn't know if the jobs were going to last, or if your plant was going to go on strike, or if they were going to do layoffs right before Christmas. It's always been a very economically uncertain area. And that's horrible. I don't feel good about that. I hope that somehow or other there is a resurgence in coal, and that I wish that the people could be able to pay their mortgages, and the kids didn't have to go to bed hungry, and you know, all of that stuff. But I just don't have a lot of faith in that. And what I have seen is that there tends to be a thing of within the people of my home state of like expecting the world to come to them instead of reaching out to what else is out there in the world, and other means of industry, other means of making money without having to leave the state. What can be done? I think marijuana should be legalized in West Virginia. I think it's crazy that's not.
Oh God, this place would boom, and
grow it anywhere. And it's hard to grow stuff in that state because of the mountains, because of the climates, and so forth. But you can grow marijuana there, that's for sure. You can grow anything. You can grow marijuana anywhere. And you know, that's another thing that's evolved over time. I mean, yeah, you know, you remember me from college. I didn't smoke that much. Maybe, you know, probably less than 10 times throughout my entire life have I smoked marijuana.
Yeah.
Because I I don't like it. It doesn't work for me, and it's terrible for my particular lungs. But I have come around to the opinion of, you know what, if you're going to sell booze and you're going to expect people to be grown-ups about it and monitor their own behavior, that's, and it's not addictive, and in many ways it's helpful. I think that, like, my mom could probably benefit medically from smoking it, but she probably never would. But
well, you might find that this is sort of ancillary, but your mom's going to get a chance next year.
Well, she's in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. Well, but we will have so-called medical cannabis in West Virginia in 2019, but nobody will be able to smoke it. We'll have it in pill form, or tinctures, or oils, or a little patch that you put inside navel or something, but you can't smoke the flower.
Okay, well, the wildwood weed is, I think Ray Stevens once called it. But anyway, Jim Stafford. I knew that wasn't right.
You're just wandering around behind the little animals.
Y'all come back now, you hear?
Sitting there on that sack of seed. Exactly.
Okay, we've lost the 18 to 35s again. But my kids, my kids are both up in Montreal. They both study at McGill University. And so they are now, I asked Phoebe when she came home for Thanksgiving. I said, so what's going on with the legal marijuana store? What's it like to go into one of the stores? She said the first couple of days was just mayhem. It was just like lines around the block and everything. But it sounds almost like the soup Nazi, though, in a way. You come in and you kind of have to know what you want and ask for it and not mess around a whole lot, And they have like all these different jars and blends.
Get out of the way.
Yeah, move to the right, exact change, no soup for you. No, I don't think they do the no soup for you, but it seems pretty.
No
pretty,
kush for you.
Yeah, no kush for you. So, So I don't know. I do think about, God, all these people and, what can they do? If coal doesn't work out for them, what else can they do? It's like, why don't they just do that? I mean, just cut to the chase. It's going to happen. Be ahead of the curve for once, get some of that money. You don't have to do it all by lottery tickets and stuff like that. There's plenty of money to be made by that.
And the one big difference, as far as tax revenue is concerned, if you say the word tax in the same sentence with natural gas and or coal, somewhere, a coal and gas industry executive kills a kitten. Because if you mention tax in those industries, they howl like they're being being murdered a little bit at a time. On the other hand, I've not read a single story, Dan, about cannabis producers and cannabis sellers in legal states saying, "Oh no, the taxes." No, uh-huh. And the tax revenue again. And this is another thing: we're talking about a resource that is sustainable and renewable, as opposed to a finite burn it once and done resource like coal or like gas.
Sure.
And in a place like West Virginia, where we're within 4 hours of like 20 million people and nobody around us has legalized it yet, it would for at least a few years it would explode, and you'd have a construction boom and a service economy boom.
Yep.
And in my tourism area, a 6 month tourism economy could turn into a 12 month tourism economy. And that makes all the difference in the world, because our tourism season's over right now, and there's a lot of people who worked their ass off during the tourism season who are now going to scramble until April.
Hmm. Is the tourism and we should get to talking to show business soon, because that's fun stuff. But let me just ask you, tourism in West Virginia, is that what? Is that like the whitewater rafting?
Whitewater rafting. This has become... an absolute go-to for anybody who's hardcore about rock climbing, mountain biking.
Are there caves? Are there cave exploring?
Not a lot of caving, because this is sandstone, and you tend to get caves in limestone formations.
Oh, okay. See, this is why you paid attention to geology class at WVU, and I did not.
Yes.
I barely graduated, in fact, because I was failing geology in the second semester of my senior year. and I had to pull out a 92 or above on my final to just pass. And I did. I got a 95, and I got to graduate.
I wound up, if my English major had not been all screwed up and they didn't allow minors, I would have had enough hours in geology for a minor and enough hours in Latin and classics for a minor in that, and damn near enough for a theater minor and a journalism minor. But
and then the opportunities for employment would just explode for all of those, partial actor geologist.
I prefer to call it Renaissance man, Dan.
Yeah. Which the world, we know that the world belongs to the Renaissance men and women.
Here I am broadcasting live from the fabulous Kincaid Mansion and the marvelous Horn Studios. So, the question answers itself.
So we might as well talk till 9 p.m., right?
Yeah, we're going to the end of the program.
Okay, good.
So, I did want to move into show business, but we didn't do much politics last time, so I thought it was fair. We'd see how that played.
And I do have some friends who are probably MAGA types or at least leaning Republican that might be listening if they haven't turned this off already.
They hate me.
Because some of my friends are very loyal to and proud of a hometown boy that gets on any media.
Hey,
like
you and I have a common dear friend who is so far down the MAGA rabbit hole that you couldn't find him with ground penetrating radar. So
does he ever listen to the show? Do you think at all? Or is
Oh yes.
Hi Mick.
Yeah, hi Mick.
But no, I was just going to say too that if I haven't turned off some of my hometown friends and Middleburn, West Virginia people who might be listening, I won't apologize for my beliefs, but I am conscious of.
Oh, how liberal of you to think about doing that, though.
I am consciousness as an entertainer, as it were, that you try to include as wide a range of audience as possible. So, and my head starts to hurt after a little bit of talk.
See, Dan, it's about the demographics. We got to get as many people in as we possibly can. We want to sell to both sides, Dan. That's what the advertisements are for.
Very fine people. All of that. I know. But anyway, I do want to talk about show business because it's just fun. And I do feel that somebody like you, Bob, I mean, you talk about politics night after night and you might read more than me. And for all I know, you're smarter than me. So, it's kind of a break that I can then drift away from stuff I sort of know things about to things I definitely
into places where you have genuine, unquestionable expertise.
Well, even that, there's always question, but that's the fun thing. I like to say that what makes movies when I say showbiz, I don't say that just because it's like showbiz. I want to include TV and movies sort of as the same thing because anymore they kind of are.
Well, let me start with a jumping off place just because Agnes and I started watching it and we were hooked and just pulled right in. Are you a fan of Mr. Robot?
I am. I watched the first season. I can't tell you why I didn't go beyond the first season, and I liked it a lot. What's his name? Remy Malek?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's terrific, and it's great to see Christian Slater again. But now you're only halfway through the first season?
We finished the first season last night.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, I guess we don't want to do spoilers on the...
For your
listeners, but that's a heck of a twisteroo that happens, right?
I'm still not sure I've got it.
I don't know. I'll have to watch it again and try to go beyond season one.
But Rami Malek impresses me as a hell of an actor because my first introduction to his work came with the Tom Hanks vehicle. After he made Band of Brothers about this World War II in Europe, they made one called The Pacific about the Marine Corps and the island fighting. And Rami Malek had a substantial supporting role in that and was absolutely fantastic. Then I see this, and frankly, I can't wait to see him. I want to see him playing Freddie Mercury on the big screen.
Yeah, I haven't gone to see that yet. You haven't seen it yet either, I take it?
No, no.
And that, this is the thing, too. For a guy that loves movies as much as I do, I've gone to very few movies this year. Like physically going out, paying a ticket, you know, getting in the car, driving to the theater, all of that. There's two reasons for that. One is after I had the heart transplant, I'm not allowed to be in a movie theater. Not yet.
No, I can imagine.
The people who could sneeze and cough, I have to stay away from that stuff. I didn't go to family Thanksgiving because of that too. I just have to stay away from large groups of people. But also too, you know, and I think I bitched and moaned about this last time. They're not really making movies for guys like you and me so much these days. Certainly not in the summer. I'd say from January to October. There's not a whole lot for people beyond the age of 35. It is a lot of superheroes. It's a lot of reboots, sequels, tentpole blockbuster things.
One thing that absolutely blew my mind. A friend of mine was telling me yesterday. Somebody is going to remake The Lord of the Rings already.
Well, I think they're making it as a TV show though, as a weekly thing. I don't think they're making it as movies.
But still, I mean.
It's product. It's a recognizable name.
Because we have the cultural attention span of a gnat.
Well,
but then the person talking to me said, hey, Fellowship of the Ring was 17 years ago, bub.
That's true. And listen, the Maltese Falcon, I didn't realize until recently, you know, the classic Humphrey Bogart Maltese Falcon, that was the third time they did that movie. There were two, and Ben-Hur, the same thing. I think there were two versions of Ben-Hur before the beloved classic.
I think that was DeMille's second Ten Commandments.
Yeah, exactly. So reboots aren't exactly new, but there definitely used to be a lot more original content, and that's what I'm into. I like to come in not knowing if it's going to be good or bad. I like not knowing that. I like not knowing what the plot is going to be. I don't care about name recognition, and I don't personally think that we needed Creed 2. I think that the first Creed was terrific. I had a fun time watching it. I didn't come out of that thinking, well, what happens next? But then again, I'm a white man in his 50s. If I were an African American person, and if I were in my 20s, or if I were any person, male or female, that thought that Michael B. Jordan was really, you know, wonderful to look at for 2 hours. Sure, I'd go to Creed 2. But for me, I don't have an interest in seeing the continuing story of Apollo Creed's son or grandson. The same way I didn't care about Rocky 5 or you know,
or
any
Jaws 6.
Jaws 6, People Zero.
That's good.
I wish I could say I invented that. I didn't.
But one of the things that I think has, you know, radio was dramatically impacted by television, and then television, right, as it grew and expanded artistically, had an impact on film, and then along comes videotape, and the studios said, well, this will be the end of movies as we know it. Everything changes, the different media change each other. And one of the things that I find fascinating, Dan, and I'd appreciate, because, you know, you've worked on serial television.
Right.
In many ways, I think that there are instances where instead of having to, say, chop a book, chop the guts out of a book to make it fit into, you know, 109 minutes, modern streaming entertainment offers an opportunity to stretch it out into 15 or 20 hours.
And that's cool.
It offers you a greater opportunity to develop character, to go into detail. I mean, for instance, I actually sat down and tried to read one of the Outlander books.
Uh-huh.
And I found it utterly unreadable. It was one step above having been written in crayon.
Uh-huh.
It was terrible. On the other hand, that first season of that show was absolutely compelling.
I haven't watched it. I don't know. It looks very bustier and extremely, extremely white to me. I know there's a lot of hot white people sex. I don't know. prove me wrong. Tell me I'm full of shit. Tell me you give it a chance. Yeah, and I'll
I mean, it's set in fucking Scotland. It's not.
Yeah, I know. It's not going to be like Michael B. Jordan showing up in that. It's Scotland. I get that.
But they do try to work in a little bit of something resembling diversity. Not particular, but okay. Let's try. And did you bother with black sails at all?
No.
Again, too much with the bustiers, or.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, plus, there's so much stuff now. I mean, this is you know, first world problems that you know we can't watch all of the good stuff. There's so much content now being created. I mean, Netflix is, you know, I think they did a sketch on Saturday Night Live last week about it, where, you know, Netflix is creating so much content at one time that you'll never get to watch it all. You know, you know every single hour of the day, a new show is popping up on Netflix. My bitch and moan about that is that means that there's probably, you know, fewer and fewer chances to watch a really great classic movie on Netflix, you know, because they'll put on, you know, their 8-part series and take off, you know, I don't know, The Godfather or something. You know, it's all, what was I going to say?
It's great great for actors, though. Hey, I mean,
it's great for people like me. It's more jobs than you know, for everybody. There's so many jobs now that you know, they're hiring people off the street to do what I do because I can't do more than one job at a time. I actually have friends that have done more than one job at a time, where they'll like sort of straddle two different jobs as prop masters, and I don't know how they do.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, but Jesus Christ, you're working the bustier, the 17th century bustier piece, and you're working the 25th century science fiction piece, and the next thing you know, you've screwed up if you're the props master, and the guy in the 17th century is pulling out a fucking death ray.
Right. What? I have to think about that one. But yes, I get it. So, but where I go with it is that there's so much on. I feel like I almost have to apologize now that when my friends say, "Oh, did you watch Outlander? Did you watch, you know, the season 2 of Mrs. Maisel or what?" I'm like, "No, you know, I'm sorry. You know, I feel like they've gotten something I haven't gotten." But at the same time, you know, it's very easy for me. I've got all the time in the world right now, but I still haven't watched those shows yet. Maybe I will. Or sometimes I go back and watch something I've already seen, which would think that would render my I Hate Reboots stuff moot. But
no, I'm so shallow. I watched Chevy Chase in Fletch last night, okay? For reasons that wouldn't make any sense whatsoever to anyone except maybe one person in this entire audience. And it was neat just to kind of reflect on back when Chevy Chase was a hot property.
Yeah,
and even that was a little bit cringy.
Hey, Dudley Moore was a hot property at one time.
Yeah, and the Harold Faltermeyer score to it.
Uh huh.
Because yeah. it for a while there, if a Saturday Night Live alum did a move, you know, an action comedy, you can bet that Harold Faltermeyer had scored the damn thing.
Do you know, by the way, you know who Michael Cimbello is?
Oh, yes.
Maniac, right? Number one. Right. Do you know that Michael Cimbello was like a sideman working on a lot of classic albums of the 70s, including one of my favorites, Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life?
I did
Michael
not know
Cimbello,
that.
Like, played guitar on that and also did like backup vocals and all this other stuff. Like, Stevie had like maybe 4 other people at most working with him in the studio. It was mostly Stevie, but the one guy that he trusted was Michael Maniac Cimbello to like help him out in Songs of the Key of Life. True story.
So when you do get back on your feet and you're out there in the working world again, you obviously won't have nearly as much time or time for 2-hour conversations on the horn or anything.
No.
You know, can you make sure and like just give us a heads up of, you know, hey, I'm working on something that's going to be really, really cool, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because I think we talked about it last time. I'm not just in this for the money. I really enjoy, and I think most people who do any crew work or any work whatsoever in films, even people in the production office who aren't on set, we all like to be associated with something really cool and good. It's really a point of pride when you can work on something that gets a lot of critical acclaim or when people say, "Oh, I love that show." You know, it's not quite the same if you're working on something that's kind of crappy and yet for whatever reason, you know, it's still on the air. It's really nice. And you know, I did a movie that came out in 2018 called Eighth Grade. I plugged it, I believe, the last time.
Yeah, we did. We talked about it.
I'll plug it again because it's made a lot of top 10 lists of critics, and it deserves to. And it's a dark horse in terms of Oscar attention. We'll see. It was released in I think June or July or August. So, you know, but it's available on Amazon. You can rent it. I hardly recommend it, especially if you have teenagers or if you that you want to watch a movie with. Rent Eighth Grade because it's not only entertaining and relatable, especially if you're a kid that age or if you have been a kid that just didn't fit in. You'll have something to talk about with the person sitting next to you.
Could you put say a lower age range on that film?
I think so. I think that I would say that it would depend. Everything's
so. I mean, would a fourth grader, a fifth grader, get anything out of it? Or
I think it would be a little better to wait to let's say sixth grade at the youngest. Just because they do talk about blowjobs.
Okay. Yeah, we'll be waiting.
Grade, we all talked about blowjobs. We didn't even know what blowjobs were, but we knew that it was a very interesting thing. You know, we didn't quite know how all the mechanics worked, at least, you know, and what you got out of it. Not all of us were certain. But in eighth grade, they talk about blowjobs. There's also a very disturbing scene toward the end where a boy tries to pressure a girl into having sex or being sexual, I should say, and she doesn't do it and she gets out of the situation, but it's very traumatizing to that character and it could be traumatizing to a young viewer. So I would say fourth and fifth is a little young, but the idea that you have to wait to the age of 17 because it is rated R, there the word fuck is uttered.
I think
twice it's uttered, but I think by the time you're in eighth grade, you should be able to see eighth grade, is my feeling, because there's certainly nothing in there that you haven't heard and can't relate to.
And you consider it to be a reasonably accurate representation of modern eighth grade.
I do. My daughter actually, ironically, had some quibbles with it, but she felt that the character was too anxious and would have been a little been a little less of a misfit or would have maybe one or two friends. And even the biggest misfit in high school still has like that one friend that they hang out with at lunch. I understand that. Listen, I think it's a great film and I'm very proud of worked on it. And, you know, it's a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes and all this other stuff.
Wow.
You know, but maybe others come out of it and say, eh, you know, I come out of movies all the time that everybody praises the hell out of or wins Best Picture. And I go, eh. You know, and it's like we said earlier about, you know, dead ex-presidents. Time really tells, you know. I mean, does anybody now go, you know what? You know a movie I really want to watch tonight? Driving Miss Daisy. That was the best picture of 1989, and I can't wait to see it again. You know, but people will go back and see something that didn't win Best Picture, like Psycho or Wizard of Oz or E.T. So, you know, time tells the real thing. And you know, Rocky Horror was a flop when it came out, and then it became, you know, a cult hit, or Christmas Story. You know, all of these are things that, you know, are beloved now, but when they first came out, a lot of critics and even audiences kind of went
It's a Wonderful Life flopped at the box office.
Yeah, you know the story of what made It's a Wonderful Life such a massive, you know, hit in retrospect. Mm-hmm. Is that you know, at the very very beginning there, it says in the credits, it says, I forget what it's called, like Liberty Films.
Yes.
Presents. And that was Frank Capra trying to start his own studio with, I think, George Stevens and one of the other greats. I forget who. And that studio made only that one movie, It's a Wonderful Life, before they ran out of money. And something happened with that where it fell into public domain. So because It's a Wonderful Life was public domain and not owned by a studio, that meant that anybody could any station could air it. So PBS stations in the 1960s started showing It's a Wonderful Life during pledge drives and during the holiday season, because they could show it for free anytime they wanted, and don't have to pay royalties. And because of that, it really caught on. And what you're saying before about television, you know, the 60s and the 50s, of course, you know, that's when people were turning from them going to the movies to going to their TVs for entertainment. So there was It's a Wonderful Life, and it's like, hey, this is a terrific movie. How come this didn't win Best Picture? But it didn't. And the same case, too, was with Night of the Living Dead. That movie fell into public domain because the production company didn't renew the patent on it. And so because it was public domain, movie houses could show it at midnight or anytime they wanted, or it was on TV. It was on Channel 11, Chiller Theater, all the time.
And shot where? The Monroeville Mall in Western PA?
That's Dawn of the Dead.
Okay.
The first one, Night of the Living Dead, the black and white one, that was filmed in Washington, Pennsylvania, which is not where my grandparents used to live. Washington, PA, that cemetery, the Coming to Get You, Barbara, I think that's nearby where my grandparents lived, not where they were buried. They're not coming out of their graves anytime soon.
Let me ask you a question. What, and maybe you can speak to this, maybe you can't. Oh, wait a minute. I've got to share a couple of emails with you.
I was going to ask about that. I'm always curious what your emailers tend to think.
Oh, golly. Let's see. Well, back when we were in politics, Lee, up in your neck of the woods, says, no Bernie, not Hillary, and can I add Joe Biden to the list and Elizabeth Warren? Because, you know, those are all those late 60s, early 70s types.
Warren, I take out of it yet. I'm more lukewarm on Warren than I was just even 2 months ago, but...
Renee in D.C. offers congratulations on Eighth Grade. It made the 2018 AFI 10 Movies of the Year list. Terry in Amherst, where only the H is silent, said Rami Malek is phenomenal as Freddie Mercury. So okay.
And my 18-year-old daughter just saw it the other night and agrees. She thought it was fantastic.
Renee also points out growing hemp can feed the world. There are 4.5 grams of protein. See, I get to learn from this program, Dan. I get taught things. There are 4.5 grams of protein in 1 tablespoon of hemp seed butter. The plant requires little water and no insecticides, and it grows quickly, several crops per year. This is a no-brainer all over the place. And Terry adds, I love the conversation tonight. Thank you.
God, I'm always worried about being boring, and I was honestly worried about the politics stuff because I just thought, what do I really have to say? What's really meaningful coming out of my lips? So I'm glad you have to say that, and I'm not doing false humility at all. I really worry about being uninformed and dull. So thank you.
You aren't, and you couldn't be, and if you were, they would offer you a job on Fox. Okay, uninformed and dull. Got to work with me here, Dan.
It's the little man in my head. What can I tell you?
Yeah. Subject line, question for Dan coming from Megan. Is it true that doctors – okay, now we're all the way back to your transplant. Is it true that doctors prescribe sexual activity for heart patients? Just curious.
No, they don't prescribe it. They do say that we can do it, and I'm not going to go into personal details at all because my wife will listen to this, and I'm very conscious.
Oh, I want to hear about the chandelier, damn it!
But I will say that it is allowable, but especially in the early parts of things, because your chest has just been cut open and sewn back together, there are certain positions and certain things you got to be a little conscious about that maybe you wouldn't be prior to that. Now, that being said, the staples are out of my chest. It's not completely healed, but it's in good shape in terms of the healing that is my chest. So I will just say that it's allowable. It's not like the movies where they, you know, what was that Madonna movie where she plays somebody that I think literally sexes a guy to death, like the old thing of like he has a weak heart and she fucked him to death, you know, and it's like, that's not really.
And then you get the Richard Pryor line, he came and went at the same time.
Right. I mean, you could kill yourself by taking too much Viagra, because that could have an effect on your blood pressure if you're a heart patient. That I just read online recently.
Well, right, and if you take anything in the way of nitroglycerin and any kind of nitrite preparation, you don't want to get anywhere near Viagra, because it'll get you dead.
Yeah. So no, if you're post heart surgery in it, whatever form is, you know, listen to your doctor first of all. Don't listen to some numbskull like myself online. But in terms of my personal doctor's advice, it wasn't to prescribe it, although all exercise is advisable. But even especially early on, you have to have limits on your exercise. When I first came out of the hospital, I had to walk five minute stretches 5 or 6 times a day, but not to exceed that. You know, the idea is to work my way up to 30 minutes, which I'm at now. As far as the sexual activity, I'm not going to say whether or not I worked up to anything.
You got to be so careful. You're going to walk into one here in a minute if we don't find another topic. You know that, really, right?
And by the way, too, I wanted to add something that I should have added the last time around, because it's true. I'm so grateful. Which is that you asked me about my wife, and I told all the things that she does for me, and she does in terms of the stuff around the house and doing my laundry. And I mentioned on this about driving me places. But the fact is, too, and just loving me and being supportive and emotionally supportive. But also, she is the income earner right now. And that ain't for nothing. You know, that she is providing. I have always been the breadwinner. For 30 years, I've been the one that has provided the majority of the income. For about a year, I've provided very little income. I had one stretch of work. So right now, she's doing it, and she's doing fantastic. And between that and the GoFundMe and just us being very careful, we're handling it. And I should have mentioned that the last time. I made it come across as if she's my maid, and she's so, you know, she's so much more than that. She's everything to me, and I felt really bad about that afterward. That I made her come across as just my laundress, as opposed to my life partner, which she most certainly is.
I didn't take it that way, but
I took it that way, and so I just wanted to.
Good for you working on being a better Dan.
It comes back to one word for me since this operation: listen. Just keep listening, and not just to others. Listen to myself. And you know, and if I say something that's ridiculous or insensitive or mean or wrong, you know, say I'm sorry. You know, when your listeners the last time around got into me naming Sopranos the best drama of all time instead of Breaking Bad, it's like, you know what? Convince me, and you might be right. You know, it doesn't take much to convince me. I just have to keep listening, and I want to.
Right. That and who played the Cisco kid and things like that. Those are those are good heated arguments that are over like a summer thunderstorm. And nobody says, you know, that guy's a total asshole, you know, thinks the Sopranos are better than Breaking Bad. You know, what?
Yeah, I know. It was,
a terrible
it was
human
like.
Being. Right.
There are people that think that George Lucas raped their childhoods, you know. Or because he dared to change the Star Wars format, or that, you know, Ocean's the new Ghostbusters with an all woman cast was somehow an abomination to God because they dared mess with your precious memories of Bill Murray. It's like, you know, just get over it. It's not that important.
All of a sudden you're Shatner at the Star Trek convention going, get a life.
Not the Shape of Water deserves or Driving Miss Daisy deserves to win Best Picture. It doesn't matter. It's all silly. What I do, you know, it's we create stories that they are helpful and they are useful to an extent, but we're not curing cancer and we're not landing jet planes. We're just making phony baloney Hollywood nonsense. And hopefully it's well-made nonsense.
And,
you know?
But you know what? I think you sell it a little bit short, Dan.
I do.
Because we live in and waxing anthropological for a moment, we have less leisure time as modern humans than the ancient hunter-gatherers had. And so any moment that we get to pull back and put everything to a side, to the side for a little bit, and immerse ourselves in a piece of film, whatever the genre, whatever the preference. The people who do that are to be appreciated. That isn't necessarily modern, because modern humans takes in about 5,000-7,000 years or so, and the same thing can be said, for the people who put up Oedipus so that a bunch of Greeks could sit on stone benches and gasp in shock at the idea of, you know, what Oedipus did. It has an intrinsic value of itself.
You know what? It does. And also, for those of us who do this, even, again, I like to do the thing, whether or not we're prop people or PAs just starting up, production assistants just starting out, or working craft service or working in the office, or the director, writer, producers, actors, we all got into this because for some reason or another, it not only appealed to us, for many of us, it's a passion. And the fact is, we are all on some form of borrowed time, whether it's 100 years or whatever it is. And again, this is post-operative navel-gazing here, but it's important to have a passion in your life, even if it's deemed silly by others. Maybe you collect Star Trek paraphernalia. Maybe you make quilts.
There's a film coming out that I think speaks exactly to that, and I'm intrigued, and I think I want to see it. Steve Carell's in it. Welcome to Marwen.
Yeah, that looks interesting. I don't know if it'll be good or not, but you know what? They're doing something different, and I want to see that. I want to see something that's I don't know what the hell it is.
I know a little bit of the backstory.
I watched the trailer and things like that.
But the techniques that they used, where, you know, they G.I. Joe-ized the,
yeah,
the actors, and
that's
cool. That's neat. That's novel.
Hey, we've got 3 minutes left, and before we get kicked off the air.
Oh, nobody's kicking.
Okay, but I do want to plug something I saw recently. It's not a new movie, but anybody can watch it because it's not only available online, it's available on YouTube. There's a movie I want to plug that very much goes into what we're talking about in terms of what is your purpose of life? What are people's purpose? Why are we here? Why do we connect, et cetera? I know a lot of people would sooner go to the opera than watch a documentary, but here's what it is. It's a documentary series. It's called the Up Series. And what it is that way back in 1963, a BBC company made, it wasn't even intended to be a documentary, it was a half an hour television show about kids in England at the age of seven. And the idea of the very first one, which was called Seven Up, ha ha ha, right? Because they were age seven. Seven Up explored all these different children in Britain's class system, so that some of them were wealthy, some of them were from the East End, the lower end, socioeconomic end. And it explored what were the differences between these children. Now, the genius thing they did was they went back 7 years afterward at age 14, and they made 14 Up. So you got to see these same kids 7 years later. And it made less emphasis on the class bracket stuff and started exploring how these kids were growing up and changing. And for every 7 years afterward, they went back to 21, 28. One person has a complete, you know, one person who had like this tremendous gift and charm winds up homeless and emotionally broken. It's heartbreaking stuff and fascinating television. And it's humans in a goldfish bowl in a way. It's Big Brother way before Big Brother, and not nearly as fake. It's real. And they continue to this day. They're now up to 56 Up, and I understand that 63 Up, that is, these people are now 63 years old, and you're going to watch them, or I hope you do, next year in 2019. And you follow this. And throughout each one of the documentaries, and each one comes in its own separate show, right, 14 Up, you could YouTube any of them for free, folks. It's fascinating. And I recommend starting at the beginning. It's in black and white. And going all the way as you watch these people, and you, oops, it's 9 o'clock, which also means I have to take my medicine. But I beg you to watch this.
Well, we will watch. And
it really answers that. Not it doesn't answer it. It really approaches that thing of why are we who we are? And does life have meaning? Yeah, it has meaning. You know, passion and enthusiasm and love for each other and family. All of those really do matter. And if you watch these movies, any of them, you'll get that idea. It'll certainly come through. And it's 9 o'clock.
It is, and I love the sound of your alarm clock. It sounds very steampunk.
It's the pinball machine one.
That's
the one really saying, "Hey, dummy, you can't ignore this one."
Okay, like, so you're going to be really good, and you're going to take your mountain of meds. And I'm simply going to observe, Dan, that we had a wonderful conversation. People enjoyed it. And we have I think we've created our own sort of serialized conversation here, because we didn't get to stuff that I wanted to get to, or I suspect that you wanted to get to. So that means, yes, we have to do this again.
Whenever you want. You know, I mean, I know that other people in the world exist besides me, so I know you get other guests on. But whenever you want, you know, you tell me, and I'll be there, Bob.
All right. Well, I hope people enjoy. I hope your friends on your side of Facebook enjoy this as much as they enjoyed the last one, perhaps even more. And apparently, I just got a note from the home office, and there will be a segment three. We've been cleared for segment three.
Hooray! Well, if there's one thing that Welcome Back Kotter taught me, Bob, it's this: don't wear out your welcome. So I can't say that I'll be on next week. You know, let's give it a few weeks so that, you know, some new material can sort of create itself. And maybe in a couple weeks or something, I'll be back. I'd love to.
Right. And there has to be a tease. So here's my tease. I want to know, even though this is outside the realm of your expertise, it's one thing to talk about writing a script. I want to know how a book becomes a show.
Okay. That's one teaser for next time.
Right.
Another teaser, one thing I did want to talk about that we won't because we're out of time, is we really do need to get to, you know, we start talking about political correctness and Baby It's Cold Outside. Next time we need to talk about diversity in entertainment, movies, TV, everything, and this whole thing of, you know, what is politically correct and is that a bad thing or a good thing? Is it reasonable or unreasonable? I think these are things that I'd love to talk about next time.
I know that was on our list, and unfortunately, 2 hours wasn't enough. But we will we'll get to it in episode three.
Gotta go, folks.
All right, take your medicine, Dan. Thank you.
Love you all. Love you, Bob.
Love you, man. Bye.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you and to Helene and your entire family.
Absolutely.
Bye now. And that is the one and only Dan Fisher, friend, entertainment professional. I think we can now add raconteur to his resume, and there will be an episode three. And I enjoyed the heck out of that. I hope he did as well, and I hope you did. And I want to thank you very kindly for spending your precious finite time on this little blue green time machine hurtling through the universe, engaging in this conversation, in whatever manner you choose to engage. I want to thank everybody who jumped in to help out, who jumps in to help out with keeping this program on the air. And come tomorrow, we'll have a $680 fundraising goal, and well, maybe we'll knock some of it down tomorrow night. Thanks to our all volunteer staff. Thank you very kindly to Sparky in the chat room this evening. Thank you very much indeed to our news ninjas. Thank you to Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thanks very kindly to John Fox in Australia. Thanks, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.